Social engineering, folks, the analysis and automation of a society, requires the correlation of great amounts of constantly changing economic information or data. So a high-speed, computerized data processing system was necessary, which could race ahead of the society and predict when society would arrive for capitulation. Relay computers were too slow, but the electronic computer, invented in 1946 by J. Presper Eckert and John W. Mauchly, filled the bill. The next breakthrough was the development of the simplex method of linear programming in 1947 by the mathematician George B. Danzig. Then, in 1948, the transistor, invented by J. Bardeen, W. H. Brattain, and W. Shockley, promised great expansion of the computer field by reducing space and power requirements.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 2nd of May, 2025, streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol city centre. Don't believe a word we say, but we do our best to share a few flashes of clarity from this Templar port turned merchant venturer fortress in Tampon Charlie's empire of lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, on DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. Very nice new version of that available. If you have any problems, just have a send a little message to the developer. If you go to the page there, which is just underneath the big green download sign, that has all the latest links to the latest downloads of the site. And you know what? I was thinking even maybe I could even host that app myself somewhere so you can just download it directly, because 9 times out of 10, there's loads of little adverts saying, oh, this is where you click. And actually, it's not. It's an advert. So it'd be nice to be able to do that kind of directly. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust agenda, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, or boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, McCarthyite witch hunts going off for anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the Rentier, World War III, or Rentiers, World War III, or wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to the multiplying crises, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, cost of living, farming, prisons, climate, NHS, migrants, the Armageddonists, accelerationist policies are crafted to make every crisis worse. It's absolutely dominating the Western world now. And the politicians have nothing to say, do they? Nick Land's techno-behaviourist dark enlightenment, cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their AI, or maybe just dead. Albert Pike's World War III curse relies on your blind obedience, everyone. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King and vampire queen Carmilla wage war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as on the British people. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, and the only right they seem interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves with the help, like the jabs, of a registered doctor. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? As we learn, you learn. Helping us navigate the West's Fourth Reich this week, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. So, Martin, we've got quite a bit this week. We're going to also be hearing from one of your friends, Brian Eno. But looking, I think, specifically this week, before we plunge into the elections and the news, it's the first time I've not voted for a long while. I just didn't feel there's any point in it, and it's terrible for me to admit that. Did you vote?
Yep.
You did? For?
I voted for the Labour Party.
Labour Party. This is for your wonderful leader, Keir Starmer.
No, I voted for Helen Godwin.
And who's she?
She was the Labour candidate, and in actual fact, she went to Barton Hill when there was the fuss with the people from Barton Hill not being happy about the traffic control measures down there.
Yeah, blocking
said,
off all the roads.
And she said she was opposed to them.
Yeah, so that's where she's got a lot of people's votes.
Of course, because it's a first-past-the-post vote, there's no point vote. You've got to vote for the best placed person to defeat the right wing, which was the Labour Party in this case, which is, and that means they won, but not by much. They got 20-something% of the vote. But there you are.
Yeah, I thought before we go into looking at the election, let's have a look at why elections are so undermined these days. First of all, a story shared with me from Jo Banks, and actually Joanna Booth is the writer. She's a local freelance journalist. She's married to Martin Booth, who is the editor of Bristol 24/7, and she's been sort of ticked off, really, for being critical of the establishment here in Bristol and sometimes of the line that Bristol 24/7 has taken. And so she's become sort of a bit more insular in her. She's not really, I think, having much to do with this show anymore and has blocked me for some reason. But anyway, I don't mind. She's still producing some brilliant stuff. And I understand that if people want to keep their marriage and keep their job, that they might have to block Tony Gosling. You know, that might be one of the basic things they have to do. Anyway, so this is in 20th of March this year. Her headline, Martin, is ex-mayor of Bristol declares he's paid by a company to which he gave a £12 billion contract. The contract with Ameresco was initially tendered for £12 billion in 2021. It was awarded for £1 billion in 2023, the largest contract by Bristol City Council on Proactis, which is the contract site and the zone. It is the equal largest on the site for all authorities. He's declared he's being paid by Ameresco in his first declaration of interest in the House of Lords. Last mayor of Bristol has been forced to add to his interests the directorship of his company 3 and 2 Limited, which he describes as a personal services company for the members' consultancy work and for public speaking. Clients of the 3 and 2 Limited are as follows. Ameresco Energy Company, who were given £12 billion contract by Marvin Rees when he was mayor in a consortium with Vattenfall for City Leap. Also, Cambridge Management Consulting, the company where ex-Deputy Mayor Craig Cheney is a partner. Empire Fighting Chance, these are all the clients of this 3 and 2 Limited, which Rees gave land worth £1.35 million for free and a 999-year lease and didn't declare it in his register of interest. And finally, the Mayor's Migration Council, the University of Pennsylvania and the Overseas Development Institute. While the Mayor of Bristol, Rees, has the power to decide on £12 billion contracts, was not forced to disclose his interests at the time in any meaningful way. This has only come out afterwards, Martin, when he's become a lord in the House of Lords, that he's been directly paid by this massive company that he's awarded a contract to.
Well, that's the first time I've heard of any of that. And, of course, you know, if it can all be evidence, and I'm pretty sure it can, then it just shows you what a revolving door looks like, doesn't it?
I found it fascinating. We've just had our Metro Mayor election yesterday here, and this weird sort of situation where we had a mayor and we had a Metro Mayor at the same time. So the Metro Mayor, it's almost like a kind of Venn diagram or concentric circle. So Bristol's a little mayor and the Metro Mayor is a bigger mayor. How does that all work?
Well, there's also the Lord Mayor who gets appointed.
The Lord Mayor is really more symbolic, that they chair the council meetings, but they don't have the power that either of these two mayors have to spend public money, do they?
No, they don't, but at the same time, it does confuse the general public that there are three different mayors. I mean, the whole point of having mayors is that there's one of them and you know who they are. So the system is a dog's breakfast, is the truth of the matter.
What Joanna's implying in this article, and it's absolutely brilliant, it's all fully evidence, of course, and this has only just come out because of the declaration of interest, and then you can then, of course, trace back whereabouts, who's been getting this money and where from. And oh gosh, it's Bristol City Council that's given them this £12 billion contract. That's a lot of money. It just does sound as if people now in politics are only in it for what they can get out of it themselves. And it, quite clearly, that's what Marvin Rees has done here.
Well, I won't go that far because obviously you've got to, you've got to evidence everything. And you can also give people the benefit of the doubt, but it doesn't look good, does it?
No. Is Britain more corrupt than, say, other European countries?
Well, I mean, Britain, don't forget the City of London, is the world's money laundering capital. So when you go on about, is Britain corrupt? We are the most corrupt in some respects, because all of the money that's stolen in the developing world ends up in the City of London. But of course, that's corruption in Saudi Arabia and South Africa. But in actual fact, the money comes here.
Yeah, it's the City Leap Partnership, this is whatever that is. Bristol City Council has approved a 20-year joint venture with Ameresco and Vattenfall on the 7th of December. The rough amount in total is £12 billion. So it is spelt spent over 20 years, so we're talking about maybe $750 million a year. $750 million. Well, what? This is the question. You know, what are these guys actually doing?
What's the money for?
This is about, apparently, a low-carbon energy strategy.
Okay.
And it's quite a lot of money to pay every year to a company to give you a low-carbon energy strategy, £750 million.
Well, you'd have thought that if you're really that concerned about a low-energy strategy, you'd fund it directly and just say this is a Bristol City Council low-energy strategy unit,
I think,
paid for by Bristol City Council and staffed by Bristol City Council.
We've got a system where honest politicians don't get a look in and crooked ones just seem to be propelled to the top the whole time.
Well, the thing is that in any system, money is the sinews of war. You need funds to be involved in politics. And of course, in the past, the Labour Party was funded by the trade unions. And of course, that's become a very problematic sort of situation now. But of course, if you in the US with the Citizens United Supreme Court judgment, any amount of money can be chucked at elections, and any amount of money is. And every electoral cycle soaks up more money than the previous ones. So to have any chance at all, you've got to be a billionaire or you've got to know loads of billionaires.
So our mayor signed some corrupt contract for $12 billion for net zero energy policy for £750 million of our money a year. The Metro Mayor, the outgoing Metro Mayor, is also in disgrace, isn't he? He's suspended on suspicion of rape and actually been banned from the premises. Now, I do find this a little bit suspicious in that you would have thought that in order to be suspended from actually going into his work as a mayor, he should actually be...
No, he's a mayor, he's an MP, isn't he now?
And an MP, he's both.
Well, no, because he's stopped being the mayor now.
Just now, he's no longer the Metro mayor. This is Dan Norris, by the way. So he's been suspended from the Labour Party and also was told he's not allowed to go into his work, his job, at the Metro mayor's office. But he hasn't actually been, so far as I can see, he hasn't even been charged. This is a bit of like a Julian Assange business.
Well, that's right. If there's something here... And there may be, I don't know anything about it, then the police should charge him. And if he's not been charged, then, you know, what's going on? What's the evidence?
Well, what's going on is you're actually innocent until proven guilty. I mean, you know, this is...
The Labour Party might still suspend him from duties because he's bringing the party into disrepute, because that's not a legal decision, that's a political decision.
But surely that doesn't mean he gets taken out of his workplace, banned from the offices of the Metro Mayor.
Well, it depends who banned him.
The offices have banned him, so he's passed to get into the offices.
Is that the civil service?
I guess so. I can find out for you, but I mean, the idea is what they can do is they can just switch off your salary. They can also switch off your key that lets you into the office.
Well, I mean. If there is evidence to charge him, then that's one thing. But this kind of cat and mouse persecution is something else. I mean, Richard Medhurst, I was reading him, you know, he's the journalist. The Austrian police have seized all of his computers, telephones, everything that he uses to work as a journalist, and therefore he can't work. He's not been charged with anything.
There is another question here about Dan. I'd love to get him to talk about this, especially if he's not been charged quickly before they charge him. We can say what we want about it. He was arrested. Now, did he refuse to be interviewed by the police?
Did they have to
arrest him?
There's been two arrests. He was arrested in Britain when he came to visit, because he's British, and he was also arrested in Austria, which is where he lives.
Who? Dan Norris?
Oh, I thought it was Richard Medhurst.
No, Dan Norris.
Back to Dan Norris, yes.
Yeah. Did he refuse to be arrested? These are the questions He hasn't been arrested,
he's been accused.
He has been arrested and he's been interviewed about suspicion of rape and child sex offences.
Yes.
But did he refuse to go and do an interview with the police? If he refused, then, you know, that is not in this article. The journalists are not... You know, if the police have arrested him, they can do that out of a sense of we're trying to grab headlines here, or they could do it because they absolutely have to, because he refuses to come into the police station.
Well,
I don't know the details,
is the honest truth. I don't know. It does seem strange that he can be suspended from all of these things but not charged. If there is evidence, surely he should be charged.
His building access has been deactivated, and his access to the IT system has been removed. So this is all starts to sound a little bit sinister. So the guy hasn't been charged. We're not even sure if he refused to be interviewed by the police. He was arrested to be interviewed. It starts to look to me as if this is rather a put-up job of some sort.
Well, let's not jump to any conclusions. The purpose of trying to, you know, work our way through all this stuff
there
is
apparently
to,
in
to
the law,
try and be
there
logical.
Is, there is no provision under the Wecker Constitution to suspend him as mayor.
Well, then that
but they've
case,
done it anyway. They've just they've switched off his
anyway.
Item.
Well, that's, I mean, that, you know, that starts to raise alarm bells, doesn't it?
The victim is being supported and giving access to specialist help, but did he refuse to come in and be interviewed? That's the question everybody needs to have answered. So these are all sorts of, you know, what it seems to me we've got is a potentially, I mean, I'm not saying I know what's going on here, possibly innocent guy who's been set up by the press and by the police. And we've got that was the Labour Metro Mayor, Dan Norris, who's outgoing. They've now got a new Metro Mayor. And the other one is this guy who's now taking money from some company. That's Marvin Rees, who was the Bristol Mayor, who's now in the House of Lords. And he's got off scot-free. It just seems to me that everything is becoming utterly twisted by the British justice system, Martin.
Well, all justice systems are not infallible. And all of these things are, you know, this is the bread and butter of, you know, political analysis and trying to understand what's going on. It's not different in Britain or in west of England or Bristol than anywhere else. All of this, you know, if you don't want to watch how sausages are made, because you suddenly think, I don't want to eat these sausages anymore.
No, that's right. You're probably right, actually. But anyway, we like to look at all these things and ask the questions that none of the mainstream press here in Bristol seems to have done about, you know, was... I tried to contact Dan Norris, didn't get a reply, but anyway, you know, I've done my bit. So rather than go on about elections straight away, Martin, you sent me an article, quite an interesting one recently, about Nick Land and about the accelerationism. And this, I think, is one of the reasons why people are becoming so disillusioned with politics, so demoralised, I suppose, is that there is just this sense that actually the special interests have completely taken over politics and nobody's going to get anywhere near power who actually is looking out for the people.
Well, that's pretty much an accurate description of the truth, isn't it? We were just talking earlier about how much money is involved in politics now in the US and in Britain. And, of course, the more money is required. I mean, in Scandinavia, you used to have political parties that were funded by the state, and that was all the money they were allowed to have. Whereas, of course, political parties now increasingly can just get their money from anywhere, and politicians can get their money from anywhere. And so you end up at the end of the line with people like Zelensky, who's made millions and billions through being president of Ukraine. But, you know, he can get away with it.
So you sent me an article from a website called... Dark Futura, .substack.com. The title of it is Hypernormalization. I think this is the one you sent me anyway, Martin, is it?
Yeah.
So it talks about the Adam Curtis film, saying that everyone in the Soviet Union knew the system was failing, but no one could imagine any alternative to the status quo. Politicians and citizens alike were resigned to maintaining the pretense of a functioning society. It does sound like here, doesn't it? Definition of self-fulfilling prophecy can be viewed in the vein of, and this is where we get into Nick Land. Nick Land's something, he has something called hyperstition. Have you come across that phrase?
I did read it and I can't remember what
well,
it means.
You know, shall I just
means,
read the no, quote? Yes. What is hyperstition? Is a cultural belief, especially a work of fiction, that makes itself real. A cultural self-fulfilling prophecy where some cultural idea or hype truly brings about the thing it describes. I mean, he's talking here about echoes of the USSR and the Adam Curtis documentary explaining it. But it's also the same with Nazi Germany, isn't it? This idea they've created in the 1920s and 30s of the sort of German master race and this fictional version of German history.
Well, that's right. In other words, what Land is suggesting there is that people in positions of influence can create realities by narrative means. And you can see that because of the social media network in which most people are embedded now, they can be sold completely false narratives And yet, because everybody else seems to be going along with it, you go along with it as well, because there's a natural tendency for people to go along with people because, you know, that's what people do.
Groupthink, isn't it? Yeah. So the mainstream media doesn't come off with smelling of roses either, does it? I mean, you're saying that social media is used to do this, but actually the mainstream press, I mean, one obvious one is the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq we were talking about last week with David Halpin.
Yes, I think what happens is that the mainstream media doesn't have the kind of power that it used to have, but social media being seen as a countervailing power has also proved a chimera, because social media is itself extremely manipulative, which is why you've got things like Brigade 77, the British Army's social media arm. They just sit there all day blogging.
And Twitter and Facebook and algorithms.
Yes.
You know, this is a very important way of just like sending stuff up or down in terms of readability, popularity.
And so it's actually more hands-on in terms of getting into people's brains than just broadcasting a lying TV presentation.
So hypernormalization is a 2016 BBC documentary by British filmmaker Adam Curtis. It urges that following the global economic crises of the 1970s, we were talking about with Stephen Dorrell a couple of weeks ago, governments, financiers and technological utopians gave up on trying to shape the complex real world and instead established a far simpler fake world for the benefit of multinational corporations. It's kept stable by neoliberal governments.
Well, I mean, Adam Curtis is an interesting filmmaker, and his films are full of very useful footage, because he's got access to the BBC's full archives.
Well, he's an archivist. He's like someone like Alan Frankovich, or, you know, there's actually quite a few of them out there that spend. I mean, you know, another one we've had on recently, Todd Ryder, spends hours and hours, months and months, sitting in archives, pouring through bits of microfilm and taking pictures of them and this sort of thing, getting records from the archives.
What I would say about Curtis, though, is he tends to see everything as a psychological conundrum, and that it's all to
a game. I think he's way Adam Curtis puts it, I mean, for example, in The Century of the Self, The Power of Nightmares, he's saying, actually, look, the whole idea that you are voting for something which you're going to get, forget it. You know, there's a whole bunch of myths which are now being sold to people that they might get and then they might not get.
Yes.
And a likelihood is, no chance, you're not going to get any of it.
No, but I think I find his films a bit like candy floss. So you actually get to the end and you think, well, what is going on?
Well, okay.
And for example,
Martin, this is a bit cruel to him, really.
I think it's a bit cruel because somebody like Frankovich nailed down Gladio, nailed it down. Yeah,
he's not the same person as what Adam is doing, he's looking at trends and patterns and the overall.
Yes. I mean, so in other words, it's a bit more airy-fairy.
The Mayfair set was a very good job, I think, of looking at what Thatcherism was doing, some of the key figures in privatisation, selling off the family silver, and bit by bit showing you who was doing it and what were their real motives, the way they were selling it to the public.
Yes, well, I mean, I get he's far superior to the mainstream stuff, but I'm still personally dissatisfied because there's not enough nail them to the floor.
Do you remember Bitter Lake? Yes. That was pretty much nailed to the floor, wasn't it? Looking at the oil deal with the Americans and the Saudis at the end of the war.
Yeah, but there's an element of conspiracy files in the way that he practices
these things.
It may
be in hypernormalization.
Yeah, because in other words, he says, then many people came to believe that Kennedy had been assassinated. It wasn't, in fact, the case, but were real conspiracies.
Really?
You know, and so in other words, he's playing a limited hangout role.
Look,
frankly,
nobody, Martin, apart from you and I, gets everything right.
No, but in any case,
he's got access to the
BBC archive and is allowed to do his stuff because he isn't going to come out. Actually, I've discovered that 9/11 was an inside job.
They do try and keep a lid on Adam Curtis. That last one, The Bitter Lake, which is, I think, absolutely fascinating, they didn't show it even on BBC4 or anywhere on the television. It was online only.
That's right. So, in other words, he's a kind of tolerated dissident within the BBC system.
Barely tolerated. Yeah. I mean, at least he probably got paid for what he did.
Well, that's
but you
right.
know
he's,
what?
It's at not least he's allowed shown. To make a living.
This
doing
reminds,
what he does,
it reminds
yes.
me of Tim Tate's, not The Power of Not, what was it called? Conspiracy of Silence. He got paid, I think he told me, $500,000 to make that documentary, Conspiracy of Silence, by Discovery Channel. And then they decided not to screen it.
But he got the money.
But he got the money. And also, it's out there. If you want to watch it, it's about Boys Town. It's about the use of male child prostitutes in Washington, the way they were being farmed, basically, at this place called Boys Town, and then brought up to Washington to be used to blackmail politicians in the United States. But, you get paid, you make the film, and then suddenly the channel says, oh, we don't want to show this.
The channel will have legal people saying, if you do this, all these people are going to sue us.
Yeah, or the CIA phoning the boss up saying, don't show it.
Yeah.
It might even be just that simple. Anyway, great article, I thought, this on this bizarre, dark future. This is where you hang out, Martin, is it, during the weekend?
Well, I spend a lot of time reading on the internet, more than I ought to, really. I need to be looking, it's a dark world, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think it's also important. See, it's articles like that I would like to see more in the mainstream newspapers, say, the Mirror, the national papers, so you can actually get this is completely taboo, really, accelerationism. The only thing I've seen really much about it has been there was a Sky Arts program called Accelerate or Die.
Well, I think what's happened,
which
actually,
was basically selling.
If you read the full articles, because I think there's three different articles there, isn't there? That one of the things that's made accelerationism people are more aware of it, is the fact that various acolytes around Trump, like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk, they are accelerationists, and they're openly so. You know, Elon Musk had a thing saying dark MAGA or whatever. Yes, remember.
Dark MAGA Technate. We had an interview with Ian. Yes. Ian
so in other words, these tech billionaires, they have their own little world view, which is very influenced by people like Nick Land.
I would suggest that this is very much like this German view in the 1930s, early 30s, about this sort of German master race. These people do seem to think
they are some kind of master race. Well, they think they're better than the whole rest of, why are they so wealthy? It's because they're just really, really so much more intelligent than you and me, Tony. They're so wealthy.
Have they been conned?
Well, I think what's happened with Musk, of course.
Maybe it's just what's their greed and their ego.
Tesla shares are crashing now.
Yes. He knew they would.
Well, I don't think he did know they would. So, in other words, these masters of the universe suddenly realise that they put Trump in power, but he's going to crash the world economy, and they're not sure whether
I mean, also those shares might pick up if there's a war in the Middle East and there's no oil.
Well, maybe.
Mightn't they?
I think
it's a bit of a game.
I think the thing about these guys, which makes them so dangerous, is they think really big, and they want to change the world. They see their way of doing things as they're reckless. They're not sort of just
fast and break things, man.
Move fast and break things, because that's the whole idea of Schumpeterian creative destruction.
But of course, what may happen is
you just end up breaking things.
Well, then maybe that's what they want.
And that's all you do.
Maybe that's what they want. Anyway, so I got also sent this by one of you lovely listeners. This is on Technocracy News. It says, Dark Utopia, Curtis Yarvin, Nick Land, and the New Radical Right. I'll put links to all these articles and some pictures on our show page. It's actually got a picture of Nick Land generated by AI, which looks absolutely nothing like him, I can assure you. And that's what AI does, isn't it? And so here they're talking about Yarvin and Land, and it's apparently a generated conversation by AI between the editorial team at Technocracy News or some associated paper. But they say Curtis Yarvin, known for until a few years ago, to a niche audience under the pseudonym Mencius Moldbug, is now considered one of the most subtle and dangerous intellectual influences on America's new radical right. His theory of the Dark Enlightenment is nothing less than a full-scale assault on the foundational values of modern liberalism, representative democracy, the rule of law, civil rights, public opinion, and the separation of powers. In his ideological universe, democracy is not the pinnacle of civilization, but its degeneration, a convenient lie designed to obscure the reality of power, unelected, invisible, which, according to Yarvin, lies in the hands of the cathedral. He calls it a metastructure composed of media, academia, and bureaucracies that propagates progressive dogmas with the zeal of a religious institution. This is his view, by the way. It's, by no means real, saying that actually, really, the academia controls the, it doesn't. No, anyway. His solution, tear it all down. Dismantle democratic institutions, replace them with a system of neo-cameralism modelled on corporate governance, a state as a company run by sovereign CEO, unelected, irremovable, and vested with absolute authority. This is a sort of Musk-style character they seem to want. Now, reason I'm asking you this, Martin, is does this fit in with your political education, your PPE knowledge, and also the philosophy of politics, I suppose? We're looking at whereabouts has this sort of thing been used in the past. It smells a bit of fascism to me, the idea that there's no elections, this guy has just got absolute authority in charge. It's a dictatorship.
Well, that's right, and there are a number of German philosophers like Heidegger who were essentially pro-fascist. And that you can see that the
Nietzsche.
Nietzsche, I think is more protean because he died long before fascism became a thing. Yeah. But of course he was appropriated by the fascists. Yeah. And of course what we're really dealing
well, he believed in this whole concept of the Superman.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, if he'd have seen Adolf that's right. Hitler, I mean, he would have known what Adolf Hitler was.
I think it's more, you know, it's more subtle than that because there's more things to say about it if you're really interested in the history of philosophy. But underlying all of this, basically, is the ruling classes have never liked democracy. And if you go back to Aristotle, he will say the real problem with democracy is the oligarchy always want to get rid of it. So in Aristotle's Politics, which is fundamental to the way of thinking about these things in the Western world, the real danger isn't that oligarchies get overthrown by democracies, it's that democracies can't preserve themselves against oligarchies. And that over time, oligarchy then becomes tyranny, and then there's a rebellion and you go back to democracy. It's kind of circular theory of how these things work. But I mean, all of the, you know, I mean, the basic, what they're trying to do is get away from the whole discussions about power and whether it's legitimacy, which are part of the Western tradition. Because they just say, well, let's get rid of all of that and go back to Genghis Khanism. You know, he got things done, didn't he?
Well, the Financial Times is taking an interest in Nick Land and accelerationism as well. Because in March, the writer Jonathan Derbyshire published a piece, The Philosophy Behind Trump's Dark Enlightenment. The English magus of anti-democratic neo-reaction has become a touchstone for the alt-right. Now, I'm not saying that Trump is really buys into all this
stuff.
I
don't think Trump reads that many books.
He probably doesn't. But the thing is, the people he buys into do.
Oh, yes. That's right. And then, of course, he listens to the last one he spoke to.
So he's saying that actually this philosophy is British and it comes from Southeast London, Sussex University and Warwick. It's Nick Land.
Well, yes, but it's actually...
Am I becoming obsessed?
Well, no, because you know him personally. There's inevitably a kind of...
Is the FT popping up in the FT? I found it fascinating.
Yeah,
here
well,
he goes.
Right, but...
The second name that crops up in connection with Trump's world philosophy is that of Nick Land, an Englishman and former academic. Together, the pair have come to be recognised as the twin eminences of predominantly online movement known as neo-reaction or the Dark Enlightenment. Now, can you just say how this kind of so-called techno-revolution where computers just take over everything with drones and run the entire world, has that got any connection, Martin, do you think, with the 18th century Enlightenment at all? The original Enlightenment?
Well, it's a doppelganger, a double, isn't it? What they do is they take an idea and then they invert it. And of course, inversion is a very common thing in anthropological studies about anything. You know, things which are black cats lucky or unlucky? Some people think they're lucky and other people think they're unlucky. And of course, in some cultures, they don't have black cats and they don't think anything about them. But I mean, this is, they've become to prominence now because they've got a lot of influence in the most powerful state in the world. And of course, then their things are happening as a result of what they
people are making money out of this.
Look what happened with the Trump withdrawing from his tariffs. So he banged all the tariffs on, then he decided to withdraw from them. But some people, definitely there, went out and made a load of money on that. They will be Trump's mates. You know, if I were you, I would buy some. You know, they were able to arbitrage that. And of course, that's just money in the bank for those people. they're very cynical. They see that they see their making of money and their manipulation of narrative as being highly clever rather than criminal.
Isn't this really a bit Darwinian and like survival? Well, I mean, we're smarter than you, so we're going to be super rich.
That's right.
And you're not very smart, so you're going to die.
That's right. It's eugenics. It's by any definition.
Well, one of the things almost all these commentators always miss with Nick Land is his connection with hallucinogenic drugs. But somebody that doesn't is Jules Evans, and we've covered this article here before, so I must put a link up to that. And it's actually the best picture of Nick. That's very much how I remember him, sort of slightly staring and his eyes kind of glassy. Certainly once he'd gone into his LSD phase, which was when he was at Sussex University. So I'll put a link into that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. We've talked about Nazis on acid before, Martin. Fascists on acid does sound like a sort of dangerous thing that I don't know if the world has ever had to deal with anything like this before.
Well, it's an evolution of past, past mis. What can you describe it as? Nothing comes out of nothing. Yeah, it's an evolution of previous ideas, but it's all been souped up. What's got them going is the existence of the internet and technology, because technological utopianism of both kinds. I mean, at one stage, technological utopianism was a thing of the left. All these fantastic computers and so on. That means we're not going to have to work anymore. Yeah. The workers are going to be liberated from work. But, of course, they're thinking of it in terms of, we're going to be liberated from workers.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And also, it's not really the internet, is it? It's more these database systems, things like Palantir that have come out of... Yes. That the internet has enabled, really. Because
that's right.
Everyone wants to connect up to the internet. It's something that you want. You want your social media, you want your news feed or whatever. You're finding you can't trust the mainstream news. You don't know whether to inject something, so you go and look it up on the internet. But as you do that, the internet is looking up into you, isn't it? And it's
That's
getting
right.
loads of information about who you are and what you're up to.
That's right. And of course, this opens the possibility. I think what we're moving towards is not so much 1984, more Brave New World, yeah? Which was another book of dystopian future. Because in the Brave New World, they're all sorted out into the alphas, the betas, and so on. Like a sort of an Indian caste system. And everybody loves their life, or they don't challenge anything. Or in 1984, Winston finally realizes he does love Big Brother at the end of the book, but he's been given a very hard time. In Brave New World, people just can't imagine not wanting
the
stuff.
They will have to knock people like us out, because people will then be able to imagine what's actually going on. So anyway, look, let's have a listen finally. And this is a sort of hat tip to Nick in a weird way. That I thought I'd just feed some of these articles into Notebook LM, Google AI program, and here is a sort of 3-minute summary of what they make of Curtis Yarvin and Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment's effect on politics.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're getting into some pretty complex intellectual stuff.
Yeah, we're looking at Curtis Yarvin and Nick Land.
Exactly. Key figures in what people call the Dark Enlightenment. And we're using this article from April 25th, 2025, Dark Utopia, Curtis Yarvin, Nick Land, and the New Radical Right as our guide.
And we know you want to get the core ideas quickly, but, properly, without getting lost in the weeds.
That's the plan.
So we'll pull out the really important bits, the main arguments, why these thinkers are actually considered significant in, certain circles.
Right. So the mission here is to unpack what Yarvin and Land are really arguing, see where they overlap, where they differ, and figure out why their ideas have this influence.
Makes sense.
Okay, let's start with Curtis Yarvin. The article really paints him as, maybe not a household name, but definitely influential for the new radical right over in America.
That's right. And he used to write as Mencius Moldbug, which some might know. His ideas have definitely gained traction.
So his Dark Enlightenment thinking, it basically challenges modern liberal democracy head on. Things like representative government, rule of law.
Yeah, all that stuff we usually take as, normal. He sees it very differently.
So democracy isn't the goal. It's a sign of decline in his view. That's quite a statement.
It really is. He calls it a kind of smokescreen. A lie, the article says, that hides who really holds power.
And who does he think holds that power?
Well, according to him, it's what he calls the cathedral.
The cathedral. That's evocative. What's that mean?
The article explains it as this big structure Think mainstream media, universities, government bureaucracies.
Okay.
But the key thing isn't just that they exist. Yorvin argues they act together, maybe unconsciously, pushing progressive ideas and sort of undermining older power structures. It's like the dominant narrative pushed by the influential institutions.
Right. I think I'm getting it. So if democracy is just a front and the cathedral is really in charge, what does Yorvin suggest instead? What's the alternative?
His alternative is called neocameralism.
Neocameralism.
Yeah. And the model is basically a corporation. He imagines the state run like a business.
Run by who?
By a sovereign CEO, unelected, can't be removed, has absolute power.
A CEO for the country. That's obviously not democratic at all. And citizens become users, shareholders.
Exactly. It's not about rights. It's more like a contract. You're a shareholder, maybe, or just a customer using the state services. The whole point is efficiency, like a business chasing profits.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting connecting to today. The article brings up algorithmic sovereignty and Silicon Valley figures liking these ideas. Peter Thiel gets mentioned specifically.
Yeah, Thiel's definitely relevant here. He's questioned if freedom and democracy can even coexist, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And he's put money behind thinkers and groups aligned with these neo-reactionary views. It's interesting why it appeals to some tech people. Maybe it's the idea of clean, rational, data-driven government. Like, politics is just messy code that needs fixing.
It does sound like they see society as buggy software. Democracy is slow and efficient.
Yeah, needs an upgrade.
Democracy needs an upgrade, Martin. That's what. So that was, by the way, if you thought that was two people talking, it wasn't. That's Notebook LM, synthesized voice generation AI. Don't want to do that too much on this show, but I just think it helps. And I'll put the full version of that, which is, I think, about 15 minutes long, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So we are basically not really voters. We are just customers using state services.
Well, that's an exaggerated version of neoliberalism, the von Mises Institute, Thatcherism, but it's gone to another level because Thatcherism, for example, and Reaganism, we've got to minimise the state and we've got to make it responsive to what big capital wants. This is, we've got to get rid of the state altogether and democracy altogether and just let capitalists run everything, which is another step, isn't it?
So on top of all of that stuff, there's also the fact that millionaires are dropping tens of thousands on young blood transfusions and cryonic preservation. Here are five ways the wealthy are investing in trying to live forever. The ultra wealthy are dropping tens of thousands of dollars on preventative measures and treatments meant to help them live forever or as long as possible. Young blood transfusions, cryonic preservation, apocalypse insurance are a few of the ways billionaires and Silicon Valley tech moguls are investing in their futures. So if you've got absolutely loads and loads of money sloshing around, you've already got three or four houses, 10 yachts, this is what you spend your money on. Billionaire venture capitalist Peter Thiel, he's popped up here again, is one of the major public supporters of research to extend the human lifespan. There are all these people who say that death is natural. It's just part of life. And I think that nothing can be further from the truth, said Peter Thiel in 2012.
Yes, and also Peter Thiel claims to be a Christian. So you have to say, well, hang on, you're supposed to just believe in Jesus and you'll get eternal life anyway instead of getting eternal life through your computer, mate.
It goes back a long way, this whole thing of, you know, the sort of trying to live forever, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
Is it Cagliostro, I think? Was it in France? Was supposed... I'm not even sure if he was a real figure. I think it might have been in a Dumas novel or something. But this guy who was... He managed to con loads of French aristocrats into believing that he'd been around for hundreds of years and get all their money off them.
Well,
secret elixir of life.
Yes, the first emperor of China... He wanted to be immortal. So he got his acolytes to say, well, what do you need to do? They said, you need to take loads of mercury. So he used to take mercury. And of course, this didn't make him immortal. He was a bit of a psychopath anyway. And it made him even more psychopathic. Yeah. So he killed more people as a result of taking the mercury.
Was that a British agent that fed him that?
Well, no, this is we're talking now in hundreds of years BC.
So maybe we should try our own little startup, Martin, so we can make you live forever if you just take Martin and Tony's special snake oil.
Yeah, love water. Yeah. I've blessed this water.
Yes, well, maybe there's something to that. Who knows? But anyway, right. I think we should maybe get into the local elections and start looking at the... since we've just explained why today's elections are virtually a waste of time. I mean, very, very difficult anyway, at the very least. I don't know how exactly you want to put it. But anyway, let's look at the biggie, this, which is the by-election in Runcorn. So that's won by Reform. By, hang on, just a bit small. So I'm
six
gonna have
votes.
To, is it six votes? My God, amazing. Overtook Labour. So Runcorn by-election was quite interesting. We had Peter Ford standing there for the Workers' Party and various other small parties. Lib Dems, a tiny number, really only 940. Someone who's a Liberal Party. So split the Lib Dem vote. But anyway, what do you make... the results in Runcorn?
Well, I'm actually from Widnes, and they did the count in the Widnes Rugby League Club's headquarters on the other side of the river. Well, it's dismaying from a leftist point of view, but I think it's very interesting that they only won by six votes. The Workers' Party stood. They got 120 votes, you were telling me earlier.
164.
Yes, 164. Well, if just a few of their voters had decided to vote Labour, Reform wouldn't have won.
Well, the same could be said for lots of the other parties.
Well,
like the Greens.
Yes.
Actually, far more the Greens.
That's right,
Greens.
The Greens.
Let's just run through what happened. So you've got 12,639 versus 645. So Sarah Pechkin from Reform won. Karen Shaw for Labour came second, just a whistle behind. And Conservatives were a long, long way behind both of those. So they were only at 2,300. So really, it was a two-horse race, isn't it? The Conservatives completely out of it, really.
I think what
the Lib Dems and the Greens as well.
Yes, but the Lib Dems and the Greens, their vote held up because people aren't happy with Starmer. But, of course, the result is that the Reform Party wins.
0.7% for the Greens is not really holding up much, is it?
They only needed six votes to keep Reform out.
No, I'm talking about the Greens.
No, I know, but the point...
0.7%. The Greens.
Yes, I know. All right, but I'm
hopeless,
pointing,
really.
But what has happened is leftist voters like myself, can't bring themselves to put a cross against Starmer, so you vote Green. But of course, what that does in the electoral system we've got is it means for all of us.
Martin, I would love it if you start talking about why Reform is doing so well.
Oh no, well, I think that let's cut to that one then. They've done very well, and if we had a Reform person on here, they would no doubt be quite
happy.
And also,
why the Tories have done so horrendously badly?
The Tories have done so horrendously badly because they're becoming a joke to themselves, even. Yeah, I mean, they were in power for all that time, and it just turned into an absolute clown show, didn't it? Incidentally, Nigel Farage, can I just make this point?
Yeah, go on.
When Liz Truss came out with her crazy budget, said the best budget ever. So if anybody voted for Reform in Runcorn and imagines that Nigel Farage is Liz Truss on steroids...
So you're not one of these people that thinks that Liz Truss was bounced out by the markets and the city?
She was bounced out by the fact that her policies
were
unworkable.
Are the markets and the city God?
Well, they're pretty powerful, and you've got to know how you're going to deal with them.
Yeah, in order to succeed in politics, you just have to do
what
they
say. Or you've got to break their legs.
Yeah.
It's one or the other. Right. Yeah? And, of course...
Well, Liz Truss has actually started to break their legs. Let's have a little listen to her now. She was speaking at a Bitcoin conference recently.
Look, I don't think there is a conspiracy of people trying to orchestrate the British government, but what there is a severe case of groupthink.
Okay.
It's very influenced. It was influenced by the EU when we were a member. It's now influenced by the sort of you might call it the Davos elite, but the acceptable thinking amongst people in corporations, people in government departments, people in the mainstream media, the US State Department. When you see what's coming out of USAID and the project they're funding, that is the way this thing operates. But it doesn't operate by a single person in a dark room, with puppet strings. It's been a takeover of Western democracies by an elite group of technocrats who think they know best and have bought into, I think, the climate change net zero ideologies are, a part of that. They bought into the transgender ideology. You know, it was unacceptable a few years ago to say, well, actually, these men are not women. They're actually men. We started off talking about the Treasury and the Bank of England and their worldview. Mm. And that is their worldview. Mm. Their worldview is Britain can't really get more productive. It doesn't really matter if tax rates are high. It's not going to affect what people do. And the only way that we can shore up the economy is by importing more people. Now, what's been shown is not only does that make everybody in Britain worse off, because the GDP per capita is going down, even if the overall GDP is going up, the amount per head is going down. But even the GDP is not being boosted by immigration overall, because lots of people have been brought in who don't work or who are low skilled. So it's definitely the way the economic models work that are produced by the Office of Budget Responsibility and the Treasury and the Bank of England. That is their belief system, but I believe it is wrong. Mm. And they set that belief system and those models independently of political judgment. And that is a huge problem, because if a future government comes in and says, we want to drastically reduce immigration, the Treasury will say, or the OBR will say, okay, there's less money to spend on the health service. Even though they're wrong, their model prevails. And you know, the difficulty we have as well is that with a, you know, a housing crisis where people can't afford to buy a house, with everything getting more expensive in Britain, it's harder and harder to start a family. So you have more immigration, puts more pressure on things like housing, which makes it harder for the British population to have a family. So it's a vicious cycle. Mm.
And does
it's a vicious cycle.
Maybe support the mega rich who maybe want their services to be cheaper if immigrants come in and maybe work for less money?
I think that may or may not be true to some extent, but I think it's been driven by partly by short-termist Treasury economics, which haven't proved to be true. They've proved to be the opposite. We've had, you know, we've had 30 years of stagnation, which is the thing that I was trying to solve. But it's also driven by this globalist philosophy of we should care equally about any human being, regardless of whether they're from Afghanistan, Somalia, or Britain. Now, I believe it's the British government's job to look after British people.
Yes, well, she's got someone who's very much agreeing with her there. Martin, what do you make of Liz Truss?
Well, I mean, she's blaming the establishment, as she calls it, for her failure. What really did for her was the Forex market.
She's blaming an international establishment rather than just the British establishment.
Well, yes, if you're going to take on the establishment in America or whatever, say we had got a Corbyn government here, it's quite likely the Americans would try to overthrow it. Now, that's the real deep state. What she did was she didn't go to the Office of Budget Responsibility to get her figures audited. So as soon as she went came out and said, we're going to have loads of tax cuts, but we're not saying where the money's coming from, the Forex markets just immediately, the guys in the algos in the Forex markets started selling the pound. And that's not a conspiracy. That's the way Forex markets work. And she should have realised that. And, of course, it's the Bank of England, and which then had to step in and restart quantitative easing. Otherwise, everybody's pensions would have fallen down a hole. Now, in actual fact, the problem is we've got far too much capitalism. And that's a result of the 1980s and Thatcher. She loves Thatcher. Mm. Thatcher created what she's now complaining about. And the market's disciplined her. You can't do that.
She's saying we've had 30 years of decline. Well, we know why.
Yes, because people like you have been in charge.
Yep. And so the other issues, you'd think the reason why the Conservatives have done so badly and Labour and Reform have done so well is got to have something to do with immigration, migration, hasn't it?
Well, it's become an issue that people want to talk about.
It's been
an issue for ages, okay.
It's the reason for Brexit.
Yeah, well, it's to some extent. It's the Arthur Scargill didn't vote for Brexit because he wanted less immigration.
We're not interested in Arthur Scargill.
No, but don't forget...
We're not interested in Arthur Scargill. It was about immigration. It's about sovereignty. That's what Brexit was about. No, and that's what reform is supposedly about, whether they really are or not.
We can argue about... People voted for Brexit for various reasons. They all wanted different things out of it.
You sounded like a politician. It was about sovereignty.
You voted for that sovereignty. Other people voted to have nationalisation of all of our...
I didn't, actually. No.
All right, well, but I'm just saying Arthur Scargill wanted to go back to the 1970s and nationalise everything. That's why he wanted Brexit.
That's how reform... Forget Arthur Scargill. I just asked you to forget him.
Well, you're using
a one-person example. What I'm trying to get to here is things like cost of living crisis, migration, the farmers, the idea that the farmers are being persecuted.
Are we talking about immigration or are we talking about farming?
All three. These are all three things which the Labour Party are doing absolutely nothing about.
Well, they don't.
Whatsoever. In fact, Starmer promised he was going to make sure that the energy bills were frozen. He's done totally the opposite. He's allowed
taken the brakes off, hasn't he?
This is why Reform's doing so well.
Yes, Reform wanted the nationalisation of the Scunthorpe Steelworks. And I feel like saying to Nigel Farage, it was your...
Aren't they there just to sort of cherry-pick a few issues to...
Well, that's right.
...to try and
because
make...
Because Farage doesn't have to make any books
votes.
Balance, does he?
No,
he can say, we're going to increase your wages...
Neither does any opposition party have
No, indeed. And they're in the very lucky position of not having run anything ever, so nobody's got any idea how they were going to balance the books.
Hardly a ringing endorsement of your leader.
No, it's not.
Who you voted for, by the way, Keir Starmer?
Years ago, I voted for him in the internal election for the Labour Party leadership, yes. Anyway, leaving that aside, the reason the Labour Party is doing so bad is one of the things on the doorsteps, apparently, in Runcorn, is why have you taken the money away from the pensioners? And, of course, they shouldn't have taken the money away from the pensioners. Stupid. Yeah. If you turn around on your loyal base and do something like that, then they're not going to like it, are they?
Right. Winter fuel allowance was one of the major issues on the doorstep. The other thing is PIP, personal independence payments from disabled people.
So, in other words, the reform so
everybody,
and Farage
everybody
are
that's
now
got
saying,
a social conscience is just leaving Labour
in
their
droves. Yes, and, of course, what's interesting...
And is there any possibility for Rachel Reeves and Starmer to bring a social conscience back to Labour, or is that just gone?
No, they'll have to be removed before we do that.
Right.
Okay. You've got to accept that they're set in concrete. Reform, it's interesting because Farage is now coming to say, well, we've got to renationalise Scunthorpe. We've got to, get the pensioners their payments back and all the rest of it. But we've also got to reduce taxes on people like me. Now, of course, if he was in power, the Forex boys would take his testicles to the cleaners, just like Liz Truss, yeah? Because he's not in power, it doesn't matter. But of course, we're seeing this with Trump as well in the US. Lots of the wealthy who backed him are suddenly realizing, but he's going to crash the whole economy. Now, some of them want that, but many of them find this a bit challenging.
So back to the West of England mayor. So we've finished about looking at Runcorn. I'll put a couple of graphics of the various results. And in the West of England, we had 25% voted for Helen Godwin, Labour. We had 22% voting for Aaron Branks. He was the number two.
Yeah.
And so this is becoming the pattern, isn't it? Reform versus Labour.
Yes, because it looks like the Conservative Party they've got quite a large chunk of people.
Is a complete failure, basically.
Well, I mean, there was a funny little cartoon in The Guardian by Stephen Colby today, and it's got... this is Kemi Badenoch's springtime fun, and she's on her phone tweeting away, and there's all these beautiful things of spring going on all around her. So, oh right, I've got more hits on my, and she's just on her phone all the way through the cartoon, reading the stuff that she's interested in. I think Tory MPs are going to be looking at her thinking, we've got to do something about
this,
otherwise
she's a loser. So just in order, it's Labour first, then Reform, then Green, then Tory, then Lib Dem, and finally...
So the Greens beat the Tories?
Yep, they sure did. In fact, the Greens were at one time favoured to possibly win, having a Green as the main political group on Bristol City Council. So these people, they tend to control quite a lot to do with transport policies and quite a lot of infrastructure, but not much Helen Godwin, let's just say a bit about her. She is one of those people who is almost like, she doesn't really have any, she doesn't have much in terms of ideas of her own. She, the idea is she wants to be the kind of person you want her to be.
Well, that's right. She's trying to just squeak home by not alienating too many people.
By being Labour, by waving a red Labour rosette and saying all the much of the right possible things as she can, and changing with the tide as necessary. And we have one of the biggest tides in the world.
Can I just make the point that this election, when Dan Norris won it previously, was a single transferable vote election. So people could vote Green, and then they could vote Labour as a second vote. What's made it more complicated now is Priti Patel turned all of these electoral mayoral races into first-past-the-post races. Now, of course, if you're going to have somebody with total power, then they ought to have a proper mandate, which was even the Tories thought, well, if we're going to give somebody this amount of power, they've got to have at least 50% support, so there's a transfer vote. The Tories, on the way out, as they were going out of power, just wrecked that system and brought back first past the post for these mayoral elections. And that makes it a lottery. Virtually anybody could have won that. It could have been won by the Labour, by Reform, or by the Greens.
Yeah, so you had three parties, that's right. Those three parties all had between 20 and 25% of the vote. And maybe if one of them had just simply not stood, they could have completely changed the result.
That's right. So it's
in fact, you probably say the same with the Tories.
Well, that's right. So in other words, our system is broken because that's because it's not a bug; it's a feature. You understand me? It's actually designed to baffle people so that they don't really take much attention to it, and the real power brokers carry on doing what they're doing. So we've been bombing Yemen this week. That's not been discussed in Parliament by anybody. Nobody needs to discuss things like that. That's what we've been doing. We've been helping the Americans to kill people in Yemen. And that's where our money's going. That's why I can't see a dentist and why the potholes are in the road. Because we've got a whole base in Akrotiri where they don't want us. The separatists have never wanted us there. But we're using that base to bomb the poorest country in the Middle East and kill people. And we're paying for that.
Well, we'll be talking about that, but staying with Bristol, there was, I thought, an excellent piece by ITV West Country this week, looking at the massive amount of, I would suggest, probably over 100 camper vans and caravans up on the Downs, which is a lovely area of green space. Just to the, northwest of Clifton, here in Bristol. And that whole area has started to be covered by these people who are homeless, living in vans and stuff. Martin, this is, over the years, it's been getting more and more in Bristol, hasn't it? In fact, Matt O'Brannan, who was a regular on this show, messaged me last week to say he's now in a caravan. He's fed up with paying ridiculous amounts of rent. So this is normal.
Well, Bristol has
what
got...
What did he have to say when you spoke to him?
Well, I mean, he just said, I've moved into a van. Because previously, they were booted out of the previous...
So we should have him in here to chat about this at some point. But anyway, the idea is that you've got a whole load of people who live around there with very expensive houses, and they're now complaining to the council, we don't want these people living here.
Well, this is a huge... I was on the way walking here today, Tony. I saw lots and lots of people, clearly homeless, wandering around... You know, no
druggies
help.
Or not?
Well, I don't know, Tony. I'm just saying they're people, and they're not.
Well, I'm not saying they're not people, but the druggies do tend to look a little bit sort of. They shake a bit, you know, and they're looking rather haunted.
There's still a massive problem with housing in this city. It's nearly as bad as London, and it's very difficult for people who've lived here all their lives to get any kind of housing. And of course, you've got people coming in, some very wealthy, so we've got quite a lot of wealthy housing being created, but it's not going to do anything for the people at the bottom end. And, you know, it's just a huge crisis. Housing is so fundamental to people's mental well-being. And if you put people under pressure about things like housing, that's why we've got the food banks expanding over the last decade, because people can't pay the rent. They've got to pay the rent because they don't want to be out of the house, whatever it is, and then they've got no money for food.
This is a system which is failing, isn't it? Completely failing.
Of course it is.
It's broken.
It is broken. And of course, it's going to get worse because we're going into, we're probably going into a depression.
Good old Acorn, they did, I thought, was an excellent job this week at circulating what they said. And they said, as a non-partisan organisation, we asked all the candidates for the Metro Mayor, and here are the pledges collected via email, community hustings we supported in Lawrence Hill. So these are, it's a grid really of the different candidates and what they think. Now they're pretty much united on most of these issues, apart from Aaron Banks from Reform UK, who gets a negative cross for everything. The five different categories are: one is for regional rehousing. No, he's not interested in that. Everyone else is. Two is having a register of empty homes. He doesn't want that either. Support in ending bailiff use. So the idea is to sort of take the bailiffs out of the equation when it comes to evictions, to stop evictions. And Ian Scott, who's the independent Labour candidate here for the Metro Mayor, said, but not for eviction. So he's kind of yes and no on that one. Action on buses. And finally, funding carers education. So some five different policies that all of these people wanted, but Reform as an exception against every single one of them. So these are all kind of social policies basically.
Yeah, well if you look at
including housing,
yes, and if you analyze the spread of the votes between the left and the right, you will see that Reform could have won here. But they would not have the support of the majority of people who do not, in fact, want what they want. And this is the perversity of the setup.
Isn't it interesting how disinterested Reform are in social policies? But there's been a massive swing to them today.
Well, I mean, they basically, you can, what's it, Lincoln said, you can fool some people all of the time and all of the people some of the time. But you can't fool all of the people all of the time. People wanted in Runcorn to give the Labour government a kick for various reasons. Don't forget the previous Labour MP was booted out in disgrace for beating up one of his constituents in a drunken rage. That's not the best way to start the campaign, surely. And of course, this by-elections give you a chance to express your rage.
Do you think it's not just a by-election, it's loads of local elections as well? But I mean, what do you think, there's any sense in looking at projecting these swings onto a general election, what that would mean?
Well, in a general election, there is often the different calculation going on. So in a way, no. But in a way, I mean, Reform, I think, are setting fair to be treated as the main opposition. Because the Conservative Party are clearly just shedding support all over the place.
Yeah, they are. It's interesting. I think it's fascinating to watch this big change in British politics. And would you like to hazard a guess as to who the top three parties are if this was to be translated into a general election?
Well, at one stage, Reform were ahead of Labour, but I think they're still just behind them, aren't they?
No, actually, Reform would get a 30% vote share, okay. Labour 20.
Okay.
That's what the BBC are saying, and the change for Reform is an astronomical plus 28 percent points, and Labour down 14 percent points. I think this is, I'll put a link to this up on our show page as well. Liberal Democrat, zero change, exactly the same. So they're number three, and the Conservatives have been kicked right down to fourth place with the Greens and others, the only ones behind them. So that's what it would look like if it was a parliamentary vote. I mean, does kind of mean that Labour have already lost their mandate, doesn't it?
Well, because the system doesn't work.
That didn't take long.
Yeah, well, no, they've not had a very good beginning of the game, have they, at all?
Is there anybody, do you think, as a leadership within the Labour Party still, who's been allowed to stay there? Because it seems that they've used this whole issue of Israel-Palestine to get rid of most of the people with a soul in the Labour Party.
Well, what may happen is, because of the electoral results going the wrong way, and because of the fact that Starmer is possibly going to take... Well, he's taken us to war with Yemen. Now, when the Yemenis fire back and kill some RAF personnel, he will then have to deal with that. And, of course, we may be... there's all this stuff about Ukraine going on. There's so many things happening. No doubt...
There always are.
The global situation now is at an absolutely tinderbox point. And it's not just going to be politics as usual in this country or any other country. So there's a whole load of things to happen between now and the next general election in this country, because the Labour Party have got a substantial majority. But what may happen is that the Labour left will rebel against Starmer. Because if he's leading us...
Is there any of the Labour left?
Well, not really.
The People's Front of Judea has been purged.
Well, no, but the point is that this. It's hard to predict what's going to happen because
I think what you're going to end up with is you are going to end up with a rather denuded Labour Party fighting reform. I mean, that's the way it seems to me.
Yes.
Looking at both of our local election here and the Runcorn and that projection for the whole swing across the country.
What reform can say is that they are now seen as the major opposition party, which they are.
They actually did get one more MP, didn't they, yesterday as well?
That's okay, but I mean, they're still a long way from, you know, a general election is 3 years away, and all sorts of things
are changing fast. You're right, actually. I shouldn't say that it's always the same. It isn't. Monday this week was extraordinary, wasn't it, when we heard all about Spain and Portugal, all the electricity going out. I mean, that's just mad.
Yes, well, I've been reading about that. Hugo Dionisio writes for Strategic Culture. He's Portuguese.
Before you tell us about it, let's have a listen to the news report from Monday from the BBC 6 o'clock bulletin.
From Madrid to Marbella, from Barcelona to Braga, it seems the entire Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, was affected by the outage. There was gridlock in parts of Madrid, where traffic lights went dark and much public transport ground to a halt. In some places, queues soon formed in front of ATMs, as once again cash became the only way to pay. Schools, shops, cafes, bars, anything that did not have a backup generator was out of action. The internet was also down for the most part, although some basic phone services were working, which was how my colleague in Madrid, Guy Hedgeco, sent his experience of the day.
I was on a train in northern Madrid waiting to depart to leave the city when the outage happened, and a member of the rail staff came on board and told all the passengers to get off the train and to leave the station altogether. But there has been a tremendous amount of uncertainty because people really don't know what caused this. They haven't had access to the technology that would let them know what might have caused it or what's going on. So that's really been the theme of the day, a tremendous amount of uncertainty.
There were tales of incomplete haircuts as barbers lost power and unfinished tennis matches. Britain's Jacob Fernley was forced to leave the court at the Madrid Open, where play has been suspended for the rest of the day. The French power network says it is now helping with supplies, and some part of Spain reportedly have power restored. Spain's government has held an emergency national security meeting. The president of Madrid's regional government, Isabel Díaz Ayuso, has asked for emergency procedures to be activated.
What we're going to do is ask the national government to activate an emergency plan so that the army can preserve order if necessary. We have part of the government team working to see how we can be of help, to see what situations are occurring and work to restore normality as soon as possible.
The cause of the power cut remains unclear. The Portuguese Prime Minister says there's no indication of a cyber attack. Earlier, the country's electricity operator blamed a rare atmospheric phenomenon related to variations in temperatures in central Spain. For now, the focus will be on getting power back to the rest of the Iberian Peninsula and finding out exactly how an outage on this scale could have happened.
Delays and cancellations have been reported at major airports, including Madrid, Barcelona and Lisbon. Spain's entire railway network has been suspended. The country's transport minister says work is underway to rescue people who are trapped on board trains. Our transport correspondent Sean Dilley has more.
Driving in busy cities has been described as a free-for-all, with traffic lights taken out by the power cut. Metros and railway networks have ground to a halt. Spain's national train operator says it won't be able to bring back any of its services today. Flights have also been affected. Joseph Henshaw was due to fly back from Lisbon, but he was turned away from the airport, which he says was completely closed.
The first thing I saw was a sort of crowd of hundreds of people almost camped out outside the terminal on the hot pavement. The terminal doors themselves were closed. There were trolleys lined up to stop people getting in. So they weren't letting anyone into the airport at all. It was completely locked down.
EasyJet say their services have experienced some disruption overseas, and it has been unable to operate 3 UK-bound flights, one to Luton and 2 flights to Bristol. The Portuguese airline TAP has advised passengers not to travel to airports until further notice. Gatwick Airport says some flights to Spain and Portugal have experienced delays, but so far it has not been forced to cancel any services.
Well, so it should be a bit of a wake-up call, this, shouldn't it, for dependency on this technology. They're saying, no, it's not a cyber attack. There's the BBC there. And it's a atmospheric phenomenon.
Well, the most interesting stuff I've read on this, as I say, was Hugo Dionisio, who's a lawyer and a journalist in Portugal, and also a trade unionist. And he's pointing out that the real front problem is the privatisation of the electricity generation system in Spain and Portugal. Because previously, it used to be owned by the government, like it was here. And when the government owns things, they're not trying to make profit out of it. So they often have a lot of redundancy built into the system. So that, for example, if something goes down, you've got something else that you can bring on to deal with it. Because you're not there to make a profit.
And also you're there
to make sure that the electricity stays on.
You're open to public scrutiny, and they will say, well, hang on, is that the right thing to do? You're doing it as a public service. This seems to have almost gone. But the other thing with the privatised version of the electricity networks is that they're constantly looking for contracts to run these networks. They want the cheapest possible, don't
they? That's right. And that then leads to a situation in all of these privatised utilities where they're just not... There's not enough redundancy in the system.
So whether it's the actual network itself, which is vulnerable, or the generation, which is obviously it's not going to be the fact that there was a massive demand on such a hot, sunny day. That's not the cause. Anyway, it seemed to me immediately obvious that this is some sort of cyber attack. But they're saying in the report, no, it's not a cyber attack. How the hell do they know?
Well, right, can I just say, the other thing that Hugo Dionisio says in his article is that it may be that this is a deliberate attack on the population, because don't forget we've been told to, don't you remember in Europe they've been told to get 3 days of tins in because there's going to be a war with Russia and all the rest of it, and something like this is part of the pre-programming, yeah, a bit like the COVID pandemic and all the rest of it, Tony. Yeah, you're following me. So people get scared, get very afraid. We don't, you know, you really need to be prepared now for something to happen. Yeah, that's what we're being prepped for, you know. And also, of course, the Iranian explosion at Bandar Abbas, which killed loads of people and blew the port up, there were simultaneous explosions from different containers. Yeah? So that looks like bombs to me.
Okay. Let's have another...
So what we're dealing with here is...
Continuation of the BBC's report on Monday. And it's just interesting to see what they're saying. But to me, it seems obvious that this is some sort of hack. The question is exactly why.
The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has said that there is no conclusive information on the cause of the blackout. The European Council has been in touch with both Spain and Portugal, saying it's trying to understand the underlying cause of the incident. Our correspondent, Daniel Sanford, looks now at how resilient the UK would be during such an incident.
The precise cause of the massive power outages across Spain and Portugal is still far from clear. At one stage, there were suggestions from Portugal that it could have been the effect of extreme temperatures on the high-voltage power network in Spain, though experts say this is unlikely. A cyber attack has been ruled out. In recent years, the UK government and power network operator have become increasingly concerned about the risks from cyber attacks and climate change on a network that was designed for a different era. Power grids are uniquely interconnected, and when they go wrong, it can trigger a chain reaction, knocking out a whole series of power stations and other electricity generators like solar and wind farms. In the worst-case scenario, the UK might have to shut down everything and do what is known as a black start of the electricity grid, which can take days. As Spain and Portugal have experienced today, the effects can be immediate, with traffic lights, petrol stations, railways and airports quickly grinding to a halt. If the power cuts last much longer, it'll have an effect on water pumping stations, sewage works, the internet and television. In that scenario, people are left sitting at home with no food or water and no way of getting information about what to do. There'd be no equivalent of the televised COVID briefings. For the last 2 years, UK households have been encouraged to keep water and food for a few days at home, alongside a torch, spare batteries and an FM radio that does not require mains power. If there were a complete blackout in the UK, the FM radio network would keep running and would become the best source of information.
Okay, well, this is, in a way, let's start where he finishes there. So forget your digital DAB radio. Maybe that's just not going to happen at all. But you will have FM and I would imagine medium wave. I mean, medium wave's by far the best, simply because it goes so far. You just got to have one generator running a medium wave transmitter in Droitwich or wherever they are, and people for around about 150-mile radius can hear it, possibly even more. Long wave, of course, they've shut that down, so no one can use that anymore. These are old-fashioned systems, Martin, that used to be used for communication. Now it doesn't look as if... What they're saying is you're not going to get television, you're not going to get anything.
Well, that's right. And of course, the AI revolution requires massive amounts of energy, which could easily, you know, there's
quite a few households don't even have an FM radio anymore.
Well, that's right, because we're not thinking in terms of how do we make things resilient.
No.
They're just rushing forward into this.
That's right. And for example, with the digital radios, they use something like three or four times the amount of power, possibly even more than the old fashioned. So, of course, this is not very green, is it? And it's very wasteful. So why don't we just go back to using the old... I don't know about you. I often find it very difficult to get reception with digital radio. It raises so many issues, this outage. It reminds me very much of the BBC children's television series from 1975, The Changes, where there is this sort of revolution against electricity and technology, where people start smashing up televisions, smashing up light bulbs, and it's caused by something called the noise. So every time you see something, I mean, we've got quite a lot of electronics kind of here and wires with Dave and Martin and I and microphones and things, so that would be the sort of thing which in The Changes they would get smashing up. We want to smash all this technology, and in a way this is right, isn't it, Martin, that technology has gone way beyond its usefulness to man now.
I wouldn't go that far, Tony. I think the real issues, as I say...
Well, we become dependent on it, and then it's gone.
Yes,
what use is it?
What we need to do is have a proper plan, like we used to have. There used to be something called the Central Electricity Generating
Board.
There is a plan.
The plan is to make it all collapse.
Well, it may be...
At the drop of a hat.
Now, all right, it may be that this is an accidental collapse. That's one possibility, and I suggest that the reason for that is the privatisation of these utilities. Yeah, because they cut corners. That's what you do. You know, if you are a private company running these utilities, you will cut corners. What happened when they first privatised the water supply was...
The Daily Express has reported, Andalusia, they have said it definitely was a cyber attack.
Right, okay, now, if it's a cyber attack, who would it be? Now, they may say, oh, the Russians did it, but it then would raise the question, hang on a minute, it's possibly NATO doing it and then going to say it's the Russians. Yeah, do you see
well,
what I'm going with?
It can be almost anybody, can't it?
Well, it can be, yes.
And this is one of
the weird
dilemmas of the modern world, is that a cyber attack is enough to trigger a nuclear war, but you've no idea who's done a cyber attack.
Well,
so we could trigger a nuclear war by ourselves.
Yes.
On ourselves, by ourselves.
Yes.
Just sit here. GCHQ has a phone call with some nuclear command somewhere, or the boss of the British Army, and we cyber attack ourselves and then start a nuclear war with Russia.
Well, we know,
Tony.
People who are long-term listeners to this show will know that NATO intelligence services have for many years been involved in very high levels of deception about everything that they do. They even pat themselves on the back about how clever they are at deceiving everybody. But, of course, if you follow the clues, if this is a deliberate attack, my first thought would be this is NATO. Doing this.
Okay, so
Spain has been causing a few troubles for the Americans.
We're going
recently.
In that direction.
Yes.
Worry ye not, right? President of the Andalusian Regional Government, Juan Manuel Moreno, confirmed that, according to the information provided by Regional Cyber Security Center, everything points to a blackout of this magnitude only being possible due to a cyber attack. However, he confirmed he had not received any communication from the Spanish central government regarding the widespread power outage, saying he reached this conclusion based on our own data. He also expressed concern about the duration of the blackout, saying, "We'll see how long this will last because the generators only have a 24-hour roughly, anyway, capacity." So it's interesting that he's come out and said that. He indicated hospitals are operating normally. We heard that little thing about the tennis match. I mean, this is a joke, isn't it, really? A tennis match. You can carry on with a tennis match without electricity.
Well, the people might need to go home and find out what's happening to their families.
Why?
Because
they can carry on watching the tennis match, and by the time they get home, the power's back on.
Well, maybe.
Well, but they just ask around the audience, can we please have a pen? Right. Can we please have a piece of paper? This is, I mean, you know, what it is, it's almost like they're making it much worse than it even needs to be, and they're not thinking straight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people in Syria, for example, during the war there, they've had to function on generators and, because, you know, they've been bombed, you know, they've had everything, the society was successively destroyed by the war, which was run by our special forces. And, you know, what's going to happen now is that all of this nasty stuff that used to be in the third world is going to start happening in the developing world inside big cities in the north.
I'm looking around the topic of Spain and its national security, and I notice on the 28th of April, what day of the week was that? Was that Monday or not? 28th of April. Let's have a look. Yeah, it was on Monday. Same day as this power outage, an article was published in Spain saying Spain's political break with Israel may undermine its own security. The real danger isn't symbolic, warns a Spanish defence analyst, Jesus M. Perez Triana. It's when a unit can't function in the field because it's missing a software patch or a replacement module. Spain's abrupt decision to cancel a 6.6 million euro contract for the import of 15 million 9mm bullets from Israel has sent ripples through both domestic politics and international defence circles. What began as a procurement order for the Guardia Civil, a routine internal security supply, has evolved into a full-blown national controversy drawing in coalition parties, legal advisers, foreign ministries and strategic analysts. The contract awarded to Valencia-based Guardian Homeland Security was intended to deliver ammunition manufactured by Israel's military industries for its parent company, Elbit Systems. Although the Spanish government had declared a suspension of all arms deals with Israel, this particular contract remained active, having been approved through a negotiated procedure without public bidding. So no open public bid. Its exposure sparked outrage amongst left-wing coalition members, particularly Sumar and Izquierda Unida, who demanded its immediate cancellation. A triumphant statement claimed it was successful in forcing the rescission of this arms contract with Israel, describing the decision as a matter of coherence, dignity and justice. The party further demanded a comprehensive audit of all existing and future arms contracts with Israeli firms to ensure political consistency. Despite legal warnings from the state attorney's office that unilateral cancellation could require Spain to pay the contract value without receiving the goods, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez revoked the import license to save his coalition. That was on Thursday.
Yeah, and of course the other thing that Sanchez has been doing, he's been going to talk to the Chinese about the possibility of cooperating with them. This is where Trump came in, and they're a member of BRICS. They're not a member of BRICS, but they want to carry on dealing with China. So Sanchez is out of line. He's a reliable from their point of view on Ukraine, but in other respects, they're going to recognise Israel as an independent Palestine.
So this happens on the Thursday. On the Monday, the entire nation's cyber electricity.
Well, this is why the state may be saying this isn't a cyber attack, because if they say it's a cyber attack, they'll have to say who it was, and it may be the Israelis, and of course they don't want to say that because that then puts them at war with Israel.
Are the Israelis capable of doing something like this?
Well, I think they are, definitely. That's definitely the sort of thing they can do.
Is it really possible? I mean, it's a long way away, Israel, to sort of get into computers all over Spain.
Yes, but don't forget the Israeli cyber warfare stuff is regarded as the most advanced in the world.
UNAIDS 200.
Yes.
In fact, they've got their people, haven't they, now working all over the world in cybersecurity.
Right. That's right.
In fact, maybe the people who are in charge of cybersecurity in Spain are Israelis, possibly even.
That's right. And so therefore, it's quite easy to do something like that. And of course, the state in Spain won't want to accuse the Israelis of doing it, because they'll have to go to war with them. So on the other hand, they just say, well, it's not a cyber attack, it was something else. But of course, the state also gets the message, you don't mess with us, we're the Israelis. And that's the message that they want. And of course, the Americans, Trump's Americans, don't like Sanchez either. Yeah, so he's got lots of enemies.
So maybe even the NSA did it for the
Absolutely.
Israelis.
Yeah.
I suppose that's feasible, isn't it?
Of course it is, yeah.
And would Trump know about that if they had?
Not necessarily.
No. out of the loop. GCHQ, wonder what their view is on all this.
Yes, well, MI6 probably know what's been going on, but they're not going to tell us, are they?
Yeah, so, I mean, that seems to me to be the most likely. And also, this idea that the Spanish national government are immediately saying it's not a cyber attack, is it possible for them to know that on the same day as it happens?
Well, it suggests that they do know it's a cyber attack, but they don't want to say so because they know who did it. And therefore, you know, I mean, if it was a cyber attack by the Israelis on Spain, then Spain ought to, in fact, declare war on Israel. They don't want to go there, do they?
Maybe not, no. Also, of course, there's lots of other hacking stories this week. And this is from yesterday's bulletin. The Co-op here in Britain and Marks and Spencer's, as well as Harrods.
Harrods has revealed that it's become the latest retailer to experience attempts to gain unauthorized access to some of its systems. It says it's taken proactive steps to keep its network safe and has reassured customers that all its sites remain open to the public. The National Cybersecurity Center is understood to have warned all retailers to be vigilant with cyber attacks causing disruption at Marks & Spencer and at the Co-op. Our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy, reports.
The internal email sent to thousands of staff and seen by the BBC hints that Co-op is concerned cyber criminals might still be inside their IT networks. Keep cameras on during Teams meetings, verify who everyone is, and don't post any sensitive information in the chat box, staff are being urged. Experts say the advice is sensible after recent instances of hackers remaining inside company networks to spy on their victims during the chaos of an attack.
Reminding employees to keep their cameras on during conference calls is a way of enabling work to continue while ensuring that everyone who is really who they claim to be and nobody's joining the call that's not meant to be there.
Jen Ellis is a cybersecurity consultant and member of the Ransomware Task Force. We don't know whether Co-op has been hit by a ransomware attack, but the firm insists the precautions are proactive and that its funeral service, insurance and supermarket businesses are working as normal in spite of the upheaval. Co-op's advisory to staff comes as M&S is still struggling to recover from a ransomware attack that's led to online ordering being suspended and empty shelves at some shops. And some customers like Amanda are still having problems with payments.
It's quite shocking really, isn't it? Because you expect, I think you're so used to just being able to pay everything on card at the moment, and in this particular case I'm having to do cash. You don't expect it to happen to a major retailer.
It's not known if the cyber attacks on Co-op and M&S are linked. Neither company is able to say when things will go back to normal for customers and staff.
Yeah, Harrods as well. The idea here that seems to me that the analysis that the BBC are doing there is really appalling, really. So saying that, maybe someone's sitting, listening and watching in on one of your calls and they haven't put their camera on so you can't see them. I mean, it's very, very easy for any, I would imagine, intelligence agency, private agency to actually just listen to the feed. They don't need to be popping up on there. You don't need to put something as a sort of black page saying BlackRock or something in the corner of it or some false name of someone that it isn't. And, of course, who owns Zoom and all these cloud meeting sites? They can watch everything. And, in fact, they are one of their part of their business model is to sell that information about those meetings that are going on, Martin, to the rivals of the business. So this is something that the people like the Co-op and M&S and Harrods don't seem to be aware of at all. That when they're having these remote meetings, that means that those meetings are up for sale around the world.
Well, that's right. There's what you might call opportunistic cybercrime, but what comes into my mind all the time is what's the political effect of all of this? I think we're being programmed for a big emergency when the deep state in the West will truly take over. We saw the COVID crisis.
You mean threats to money, threats to food?
Yes, that's right.
So you keep
everybody on the back foot, and then you carry on with your plan for world domination.
Sounds like the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Well, it is, because I don't think...
galloping down the road.
It doesn't sound very rational, any of this, but this is one of the problems. You know, Hitler wasn't a very rational guy, but he did an awful lot of damage.
So I think we'll wind up with a bit of reality. I was hinting at it earlier on, which is the van dwellers on the downs here in Bristol, and before the break, and we'll have a listen to Callum Barber. So the vehicle dwellers, Martin, whose side, I would imagine you're on the side of them, but I mean, you can understand, what can't you, that people with valuable properties up on the downs don't want to see the downs turned into some sort of massive caravan park.
No, there's no easy solutions here. I think the
You know what, there are. I think there are. What you do is you find large tracts of land between St Paul's and St Werburgh's. There's a massive tract of land which is being land banked by Places for People, one of the social housing companies. You could stick electricity points in there. You could put water points in there, and you could have a whole bunch of people in there living rent free.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm not saying that there are no solutions. I'm just saying that it's difficult because all of these things, people not having
money. The
council
have got a lot of land, is what I'm saying.
Yes,
so they could make it available for these people, but no, they've got to go and park up on the downs.
Yes, okay, so that's one simple thing that could
they
be
should
done.
Accommodate these people as human beings,
yes,
rather than see them as a nuisance.
I appreciate
they're
all
not making
that,
enough
but
money,
you're
they're not paying council tax.
Well, that you're going to find that the locals who are paying council tax will say, well, I'm not paying my council tax to have these
people.
You
really think
there.
So? You think the people of Clifton are going to stop paying their council tax?
No, but that they resent paying it. But then they want their
is
pound of flesh.
Is that what this is about, do you think? That they're looking at people out there who are not paying any council tax, but are also living up in a very nice part of town?
Well, I think the problem is that people move to Clifton, as they've always done, to get away from everybody else in Bristol. That's how the whole suburb
rise
developed.
Above it all, yeah.
And then they turn up.
Anyway,
like
some
a bad
very,
penny.
Very nice, as you would imagine, very nice and very smart people living up there in vans. I don't know quite where Matt is. We'll have to ask him next week. But
he's on Muller Road somewhere.
Here's Callum Barber. He's one of the dwellers up there, and he's very, very switched on as to the whole idea of property prices and property values.
I cannot afford to buy a house, and I cannot really afford to rent meaningfully. If I did, I'd be living paycheck to paycheck, right? So I'm forced to live in a vehicle, and that's how I'm experiencing the housing crisis. These people who've got assets, they've got wealth, they've got a house, they're experiencing it because there's van dwellers on the downs. Now, I would say to them is that the rise in the value of their asset is directly proportional to the rise of the number of van dwellers. If they're happy to lose money on their asset, that would bring down housing prices so we could actually wouldn't have to live in vans. But has anybody talked about that? Has anyone said, yeah, I'm happy for the value of my house to go down by 100,000 and that would maybe clear some of these van dwellers? No, no one said that.
So if their house prices, can you just disentangle that for us? He's saying if their house price goes down, then they're happy to accommodate the van dwellers.
No.
The value of their home.
Well, I mean, what's happened is that they fear the values of their homes will be affected by the vans being there. And therefore,
but
it's
also the general market. He's also talking about the market in general, isn't he? He's saying, well, they are benefiting from this massive house price bubble, but they're personally benefiting from it financially, but they're not prepared to live with the consequences, which is these vehicles there.
Yes, and as individuals, they're not to blame for the mess. The mess is the policies that have been pursued over many years.
It's the
years.
Same with the migrants, isn't
yes.
it, really? Yeah, exactly the same. That everyone wants to point the finger at the migrants, where actually it's the system. Anyway, Brian Eno was one of your... Why is it you like Brian Eno? You talk about him quite a lot, don't you?
Well, he's one of the people that I listen to the music of, and he's obviously a thoroughly decent chap.
He is.
One of us, I would say.
He is. A bit of an old-school boy. So anyway, he had this to say about the wealth divide.
It's obvious to me that there's a feedback loop involved in wealth, which is to say, if you get a little bit rich, you are very likely to get richer. Mm. It works the other way around with poverty. If you get poor, you're very likely to get poorer. Mm. So those things are not self-correcting. They, you know, it doesn't work. There's not the trickle-down theory that people used to believe in the 70s and 80s, that it's good for people to get rich because that money gradually gets dispersed among poorer people, so it helps them. But it isn't what happens. The rich accumulate more and more wealth. It doesn't trickle down to anybody. It trickles up, actually.
Mm. And Labour have obviously been very, very reluctant to speak about a wealth tax because they say that it might drive wealth creators or business people out of the country. Do you agree with that assessment?
I don't think that's true. I think some people will leave because there are some people who are mean-minded to the extent that they would rather go and live in some whole country than pay an extra few thousand quid a year rent. So there are those people. Frankly, I'd be pleased if they f***ed off and went and lived there. Excuse my language. But rich people really f*** me off a little bit, because it's so small-minded to think that the only thing that matters is the number that you have in the bank. It's just amazing to me. Don't we love life because we love seeing everybody else enjoying it as well?
And it also seems that once you've got your house or houses and you can go on your nice holidays, what more do you want, really? Like, what do you need that extra money for?
I would love to know what you need that extra money for. You need it to impress your rich friends. You know, I remember seeing an interview with Carlos Slim once on television, and he was at that time one of the richest men in the world. He may still be, but he's doing the interview and being very smooth about how wealthy he was, and then an aide comes in and whispers something into his ear, and he suddenly freaks out and he says, "What? No, that can't be true." And he stops the interview. It turns out that what the aide says is the Sunday Times rich list has just been published and you're number 11, and he had expected to be number 8.
I can't imagine what that must feel like. Complete disappointment.
Can you imagine being in that state of mind where what really matters to you is where you are in the top 20 of richest people in the world?
Well, I mean, that's you know, you would have thought in basic economic theory, there's diminishing marginal utility. So that, you know, you the first banana you eat, you really like. The second one, yeah, I quite like it. The third one, not so much. And the fourth one, maybe I can't be bothered with it. Wealth, on the other hand, as Thorstein Veblen, the economist, pointed out, once you've got it, it's addictive. Yeah, you want more of it and more of it. And, of course, what you're ultimately doing is having wealth is actually... it's actually a competition amongst the wealthy to get wealthier.
I mean, also,
so you don't, because you'd have thought most people, if they were rational, once you've made, I mean, I used to see pop stars or whatever, and
once you've got over billions and billions,
what do you need anymore?
It's no longer about the money. It's about what you can use that money, the power you can, and
that's
also
right,
of course,
about power, because money is power.
That's the drug. Okay.
Be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to St. John. Glory to you, O Lord. In the evening of that same day, the first day of the week, the doors were closed in the room where the disciples were, for fear of the Jews. Jesus came and stood among them. He said to them, "Peace be with you," and showed them his hands and his side. The disciples were filled with joy when they saw the Lord. And he said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father sent me, so am I sending you." After seeing this, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. For those whose sins you forgive, they are forgiven. For those whose sins you retain, they are retained." Thomas, called the twin, was one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. When the disciples said, "We have seen the Lord," he answered, "Unless I see the holes that the nails made in his hands, and put my finger into the holes they made, and unless I can put my hand into his side, I refuse to believe." 8 days later, the disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. The doors were closed, but Jesus came in and stood among them. "Peace be with you," he said. Then he spoke to Thomas, Put your finger here. Look, here are my hands. Give me your hands. Put it into my side. Doubt no longer, but believe. Thomas replied, My Lord and my God. Jesus said to him, You believe because you see me. Happy are those who have not seen and yet believe. There are many other signs that Jesus worked and disciples saw, but they're not recorded in this book. These are recorded so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing this, you may have life through his name. The Gospel of the Lord.
Friday on the farm, his rabbit pie day. So every Friday that ever comes along, I get up early and sing this little song. Run, rabbit, run. Run, rabbit, run. Bang, bang, goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run. Run, rabbit, run. Don't give the farmer his fun. He'll get by without his rabbit pie. So run, rabbit, run. Run, rabbit, run. Bang, goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run. Don't give the farmer his fun. He'll get by without his rabbit pie. So run, rabbit, run.
Rabbit. You got a beautiful chin. You got beautiful skin. You got a beautiful face. You got taste. You got beautiful eyes. You got beautiful thighs. You got a lot without a doubt, but I'm thinking about blowing you out. 'Cause you won't stop talking, why don't you give it a rest? You got more rabbit than Sainsbury's. It's time you got it off your chest. Was just the kind of girl to break my heart in two. I knew right off when I first met my eyes on you. But how was I to know you've been my earholes too? With your incessant talking, you're becoming a pest. Rabbit. Now you're a wonderful girl. You got a wonderful smell. You got wonderful arms. You got charm. You got wonderful hair. We make a wonderful pair. Now I don't mind having a chat, but you have to keep giving it that. No, you won't stop talking, why don't you give it a rest? You got more rabbit than Sainsbury's. It's time you got it off your chest. Now you were just the kind of girl to break my heart in two. I knew right off when I first met my eyes on you. But how was I to know you'd bend my ear holes too? With your incessant talking, you're becoming a pest. Rabbit, bunny, jabber, rabbit, bunny, jabber, rabbit, bunny, jabber, rabbit, bunny, jabber, rabbit.
Chaz and Dave, a little bit politically incorrect. Not sure the woke team would like that one. From the beginning of the Thatcher era, 1981. Before that, we had Flanagan and Allen, Run Rabbit Run. I'm not sure quite when that's 1941, actually, that one was. And before that, we had the Kaiser Chiefs, I Predict a Riot. And at the very start, we had music from RTE this Sunday, which was broadcast possibly even live from Killarney Cathedral and the southwest of Ireland. And that is in County Kerry, I do believe. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Choice, I suppose we're going to have to go, Martin, for the main news of the week with more from Gaza, I think. What do you think? I mean, well, it's just, I mean, for example, we had, I think, was it Declassified UK this week, managed to pin down the chief of the army, stuck a camera in his face and asked him why he was spying for Israel?
I didn't see that, so if you're going to inform us on that front, can that be interesting?
I'm outside the Ministry of Defence in London because I want to get answers about why Keir Starmer keeps sending military surveillance flights over Gaza and sharing that intelligence with Israel. Who better to get those answers from than the head of the British military himself, Admiral Sir Tony Radakin? We've seen that he's due to speak in Parliament later today, and there's a chance that he might just walk out of the Ministry of Defence behind me and head over there on foot. I know it's unlikely. There's probably tunnels below our feet, or he could be whisked away in an armoured vehicle. But it's a lovely sunny day here in London, and I've got a hunch that he might just decide to walk along the embankment by the river and into Parliament that way. So let's see how this goes. Let's see if we can finally get answers to these questions that I know many of you have as well, about why Britain keeps spying for Israel when its Prime Minister is wanted by the International Criminal Court.
Has he had a
tip-off?
I wonder.
Admiral Radakin, Chief of the Defence Staff, lovely to meet you today. I'm a journalist from Declassified UK. We've been trying for months to get answers about the Royal Air Force surveillance flights that you're sending over Gaza and the intelligence that you're sharing with Israel. Have you got any comment on those that you can give to us?
To a public accounts committee hearing, and I don't really have time for this conversation, thank you.
I understand, but this is a matter of the gravest importance. Israel's Prime Minister is wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes. Are you going to tell the Public Accounts Committee how much these flights are costing the public, at the bare minimum? Do you have concerns about sharing intelligence with the Prime Minister of a country that's wanted by the International Criminal Court, Admiral? Is this why you joined the military, sir? Are you a disgrace to your uniform? Do you have trouble sleeping at night, seeing the images coming out from Gaza, knowing that you're sharing intelligence with the military, which is... We're journalists, we're allowed to ask questions of the Chief of the Defence Staff. We're here with Britain's most senior military official. He's on his way to Parliament, but he won't answer questions from the press about why the Royal Air Force has sent over 500 surveillance flights over Gaza since December 2023. He won't tell us how much those cost, even though he's going to a public accounts committee to talk about the defence budget. And he won't tell us why he keeps sharing intelligence with Israel, a country that's being investigated for genocide, a country whose Prime Minister is wanted for war crimes, including the crime of starvation, by the International Criminal Court. And we are being pushed away from him by armed police who are escorting him into Parliament.
So that's Phil Miller at Declassified UK, Martin. Quite an important little job he's done there, but we didn't see that on the BBC, ITV or anywhere else.
No, and I probably missed it because I don't get most of my information through any kind of video I read. So that's probably why I missed that.
Well, it's actually there on Declassified UK.
Yeah.
So that's, well, that's no excuse.
Well, I mean, I try and keep up things, but I can't keep up with everything. But of course,
I don't really have time for this conversation, he says. Is he really that pressed for time as he's walking across the road?
What he's doing is he can see he's being ambushed here, and he's just trying to get out of the situation.
If it was an ambush, he'd be dead, wouldn't he?
Well, yes. Maybe some Palestinian might decide to do that, or some Russian at some point. Russian generals are absolutely fair game, apparently.
Why is it Declassified UK and Phil Miller are doing this, and the mainstream press just don't?
Because...
And anyway, when these guys do it, I suppose they don't have to sell it, this footage, but I would imagine that if they were offered a going rate for the footage, BBC, ITV, etc. would use that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we know what's going on. There's a deliberate attempt to control the narrative, costing millions, And, you know, they're not going to give way to what they regard as troublemakers like Declassified UK.
But they're not troublemakers.
No, they're not.
They're actually supporting the international law.
Indeed.
It's not a troublemaking.
No, I know. I get the point, Tony. But you can see that they don't... Corporal Jones used to say they don't like it up in Mr. Mannering, do they?
Okay, so he just refuses to engage. So what would you like to answer for him? We know, Mr. Tony Radican, why you're doing this, and this is why. Would you like to explain that one?
Because the Zionist lobby in British politics and within the state is dominant, and because we obviously a lot of what our intelligence services and armed forces do is follow the lead of the United States. You know, bigger boys told us and ran away.
Actually, isn't this Israelis just telling the Brits what to do here, isn't it?
No, the US is that in order to keep in with the US, the British have to be in with the Israelis. So what's happened this week, where the RAF carried out an airstrike directly from Akrotiri into Yemen, the first one that's been ordered by Keir Starmer, is because Britain is showing itself that nobody else wants to get involved in this for obvious reasons.
The Spanish don't.
No, the Spanish certainly don't. So we're going to get involved in this, so Trump will like us more, and then he's going to agree with us that we can go to war with Ukraine. Yawn. Roll of the eyes, and also, of course, we might get a trade deal, which will ruin our farmers.
So this is all just about these other bigger deals, nothing to do with human rights. They don't even.
No, that's right. And of course, Starmer is now, having ordered that airstrike, because we were promised, if you remember, after the Chilcot inquiry, that we would never go to a war with another country without a debate in Parliament, which is what stopped the strikes.
Oh, he's a bit of a chancer, Starmer, isn't he?
Well, he
bit
is,
of
yes.
A chancer.
Yes, because one of the things that may happen is one of the British ships in the Gulf, or Akrotiri itself, will be hit by a Houthi missile, and maybe a number of our people will be killed.
Do you think the Americans might, or the British might, sink one of their own ships? To try and escalate things?
No, I think the point...
I mean, they're looking for an excuse to escalate this, aren't they?
Don't forget, we've got our aircraft carriers. It's now at Diego Garcia with the Americans because they're planning for the attack on Iran. And, of course, if Starmer does go along with an attack on Iran, with Britain joining in, then I think even the worm turns, you might find some Labour MPs thinking, hang on a minute, this is a disaster. Because, of course... What did for the Labour Party in the past was Tony Blair and the Iraq War.
Do you think Keir Starmer has the ability to recognise a disaster when it's about to hit him in the face?
No, I think what it is, he's a very mediocre politician. He doesn't think the big stuff. He tries to be Mr. Sensible, within narrow limits. He wants the establishment to like him. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He regards people... I mean, one of the things they're going to say about the reform victory in the Runcorn by-election, but Farage loves Putin, and we hate Putin. But, of course, the Americans are more ambivalent. So he's very, very close to the deep state, Starmer, and I don't think he realises that Britain, in fact, is incredibly vulnerable. Having a base like Akrotiri means it's there to be attacked. Houthi missiles couldn't possibly reach Britain itself, but that base, definitely.
Meanwhile, there's a flotilla of humanitarian aid heading from Malta over towards Gaza. Israel has bombed it. We're using drones. A similar aid convoy was attacked by Tel Aviv in 2010, killing 10 people and injuring dozens more. A ship carrying supplies bound for Gaza was attacked by Israeli drones in international waters today. According to the activist group that organised the flotilla, the vessel reportedly took at least one direct hit to its hull and has sustained damage from fire, forcing its crew to issue an urgent call for help. Now, it doesn't help that the organisers with the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, the FFC, have been trying to keep a very low profile, keep out of the news. They think that this is going to save them from Israeli attacks. Quite clearly, this is a rather silly strategy.
Yes. But on the other hand, this is the sort of thing the Israelis are going to do, and what they have achieved is they're demonstrating that we are trying to help, they're trying to destroy what we're trying to do. It's all a struggle, isn't it? Let's face it.
The FFC spokesman, spokesperson, so I've no idea what sex they are, Callum Butterley, not Butterfly, Butterley, Utterly Butterley, later told Reuters the ship was struck en route to Malta, where it was scheduled to pick up other activists, among them climate campaigner Greta Thunberg and retired US Army Colonel Mary Ann Wright. The group said it arranged the aid shipment under a media blackout to avoid potential attacks. So this is a silly idea. Where did they get that idea from?
Well, they're doing their best, Tony.
They're trying to hide.
Yes, but they're because if you've got Greta Thunberg on the ship, right, that could be a real coup, yeah? What if the Israelis killed Greta Thunberg? They killed loads of people on the Marvin...
It would be quite brave of her to do it, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm pleased that she's taking that stand, yeah?
But she isn't, apparently, because now it's been bombed on the way to pick her up.
Well, there you are.
So...
Well, that's why the Israelis would have done it. But, of course, our friend Cliff Hanley, who's dead now, he was on the original Mavi Marmara ship, and he was grazed, a bullet grazed him. And he was nearly killed.
Lots of else going on. Netanyahu this week has announced that freeing the hostages is no longer a priority. The destroying their enemies is the big priority. Freeing the hostages, not, apparently.
Yes, and the families of the hostages have said, well, they're obviously not happy. But, I mean, it's been clear from the get-go that he doesn't care about the hostages. They killed more of the...
They've killed empty more of
the
words,
hostages.
Really.
The Israelis have killed more of these hostages than Hamas has.
Israel is preparing a major mobilisation to ramp up its Gaza operations.
Yep. Well, we're going to see as we go out through the summer the whole world watching while a whole population is brutally murdered. If that's not a cause for World War III, it should be.
Tel Aviv is calling tens of thousands of reservists into active duty as the IDF fights a myriad of wars in Syria, Lebanon and the occupied Palestinian territories. Many Israeli reservists have already served in multiple deployments and are threatening to ignore orders to redeploy.
Well, I mean, the Israeli military is designed for blitzkrieg. Attritional warfare is not really what they're good at.
Well, they're suffering from attrition as well, aren't they?
That's right.
They're starting to wear them down.
Yeah, but they haven't defeated... I mean, what's really significant is what's going to happen with Iran, because I think they are pushing for an attack on Iran. The Iranians know that that's what they're pushing
for. Well, Hegseth, he's the US Defence Secretary, yep. Is it? He has been threatening Iran about Yemen. He's saying, look, you're supplying these Yemenis and we're going
to... Yeah, so in other words, even if Iran was to negotiate on the nuclear power thing, which obviously they're prepared to do because they want to be seen...
He says Iran will face consequences for supporting the Houthis. But actually, the Houthis are just Yemen. They're not really the Houthis. They're the Yemenis.
Well, they're an Nasrullah, and they are the government of Yemen. That's how they regard themselves.
Well, they are. There was a civil war which was started by, is it Hadi, the guy that the Saudis and the British and the Americans put in there?
Yeah.
And he was beaten, so he's gone.
Yes.
And so this is now the government. So just stop calling them the Houthi rebels. They are the Yemenis.
Yes. They are. And, of course, what they're doing is extremely admirable. There's been loads of civilian casualties because what Trump has decided to do, Biden was trying to bomb the Houthi military targets, but it's very difficult.
He's a nasty piece of work, this Hegseth guy, isn't he?
He certainly says,
message to Iran, he says, in big letters, Iran, capital letters. We see your lethal, and more big letters, support for the Houthis. We know exactly what you're doing. Hegseth wrote on X, you know very well what the US military is capable of, and you were warned. You will pay the consequence written in capital letters, at the time and place of our choosing.
Yes, well, don't forget that Nasrullah have been fighting a war against Saudi Arabia, backed by the British military, for a decade. They've been bombed and bombed and bombed and bombed and bombed.
Isn't it about 300,000 casualties?
That's right. And the fact is that they've become very good at what they do. And because of this, they've called this Operation Rough Rider. It was previously called Prosperity Guardian under Biden. It's Operation Rough Rider. The Rough Riders were a paramilitary force which invaded Cuba, led by Theodore Roosevelt in the 1900s. Okay, and the Rough Riders, he led them in a charge at the Battle of San Juan or whatever it was. So this is definitely the Americans. You know, we dealt with the Spanish in the 1890s, and we're going to deal with you Houthis now. Now, the only way to stop the Houthis firing at Israeli ships going up to the Suez Canal is to get a ceasefire in Gaza. They stopped. when there was a ceasefire, and they restarted it when the Israelis broke the ceasefire. They are fighting. They've got their own reasons for supporting Palestine. They've always been very supportive of the Palestinian cause, nothing to do with Iran. And the fact is, if they're going to use that as an excuse to attack Iran, which they may do, then we're going to see where the war's going to go, because the Iranians have got the capacity to wreck the Israeli military on its home turf.
In Yemen, the US have used a GBU-39 bomb to strike a Yemen migrant facility.
That's right, they killed a load of migrants.
Killed 68 migrants, actually. The remnants of a US GBU-39 bomb were found at the location of a US airstrike on a migrant facility in Sadr in northwest Yemen. Dropsite News reported on Thursday this week. According to Yemeni media, the US strikes on the facility killed 68 people, and all the casualties appear to have been African migrants who were detainees there. I mean, this is horrific.
Yeah, but it's what the you know, if
what the hell do the Americans think they're doing?
Well, if you've got a hammer in your hand, every problem looks like a nail, doesn't it? You just bomb. Trump's not really a military strategist. He just knows we can bomb them and we can kill them, and then that'll put them under pressure. And then,
but these people aren't even, these people about, are, you know, detainees, for goodness sake. Migrant detainees.
Yes.
I mean, what the hell's the point of that?
Well, there is no military point.
So people are putting them in prison. The Yemenis have put them in jail, and so the Americans kill them all. I mean, this is just, it seems insane, absurd, and random.
Well, can I just point out what the absurdity of all of this? When the ceasefire was on, and the Houthis were abiding by it, the you know, you could get insurance to go into the Gulf, and then that things could just come back to normal. But if you're going to fight a battle in the Gulf, which is what they're doing, nobody, Lloyd's isn't going to insure anybody to go through there. So in actual fact, the British and Americans here, or the Americans and the British, have actually, they're the ones who've closed the Suez Canal. Nasrallah weren't doing that. They said, as long as you're not going to Israel, we'll let you through.
Well, where they're bombing, it seems, it depends on all sorts of... This is a website, Dropsite News. They're reporting that the Pentagon may have drawn on anonymous social media accounts in targeting certain sites in Yemen. A deadly airstrike in Yemen that killed 8 civilians appears to target coordinates posted by social media analysts. These are the sort of people like Bellingcat, these kind of characters. It says over the past several months, the US military has been carrying out a bombing campaign in Yemen aimed at forcing the Ansarallah government, otherwise known as the Houthis, to stop their military intervention on behalf of Palestinians under the Israeli assault in Gaza. This campaign's conducted strikes against over 800 targets, so we're at war with Yemen, basically, as well as verified claims of civilian harm, including a strike against a detention facility we were just talking about, housing African migrant that killed nearly 70 people. It would be comforting to think the decision makers in the US military are carrying out these strikes with great care. Obviously they're not, with the highest quality of intelligence. But a Twitter account operated by an individual whose bio says they're based in the Netherlands, using the handle at Vlekihond, that's Vlekiehond, apologised this week after US struck coordinates she erroneously suggested were the location of an underground Houthi military position. It was not a military site. All right, time for me to go through the mud, Vlecki posted. Based on satellite imagery, I've marked this quarry as an underground base and tweeted it out as such. I'm fairly certain CENTCOM doesn't take their targeting data from me, but this is still a very severe mistake. She'd highlighted the coordinates in a thread that claimed to have uncovered a Houthi base. I relied on a secondary account whose bio suggests they're based in Houston. So she said that there might be a missile launcher there. Actually, it wasn't. It was just a civilian site.
Well, what gets me about it
is... The Americans are using these sort of random silly things on Twitter to target Yemen.
Yes. And the good news is they're losing. Did you see that an aircraft carrier had to carry out a U-turn to escape an incoming attack from the Houthis, and a plane fell off the deck and was lost.
That's 50 million quid down the drain.
That's right, yeah.
Oh.
And of course the thing about the Houthis, their stuff is cheap as chips. And what they've got, but if it does come to a shooting war between Yemen and Iran and the Western powers, with China and Russia at their back, it's going to be defeat for the Western powers. And I have to say, at this point in time, That's probably what I would like to see happen. They need to be defeated.
Okay, so this week was Independence Day over in Israel. That was reported on by the BBC.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that the supreme goal of the war in Gaza is victory over Israel's enemies, rather than the return of the hostages. The main group that represents the hostages' families in Israel has reacted to his comments with anger. Meanwhile, the UN humanitarian chief has called on the Israeli government to lift what he called its brutal blockade of Gaza. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher reports from Jerusalem.
Critics of Mr. Netanyahu in Israel have time and again accused the Prime Minister of prioritising the continuation of the war in Gaza over the fate of the remaining hostages there. Speaking at an event in Jerusalem to mark Israel's Independence Day, Ms. Netanyahu made clear that this was indeed his aim.
This war has a supreme objective, and that supreme objective is victory over our enemies, and we will achieve it.
The Hostages and Missing Families Forum in Israel immediately issued a statement expressing its alarm, insisting that returning the hostages must be the supreme goal that should guide the Israeli government. Israel is a country divided by the resumption of the war in Gaza, but there appears to be a majority who believe that freeing the hostages should be the priority. They take to the streets week after week to make their feelings known. In Gaza, Israel's blockade of aid supplies has now lasted for 2 months amid increasingly urgent warnings of the consequences from aid agencies. The UN humanitarian chief, Tom Fletcher, has issued a statement saying that Israel has been blatantly honest about its aim to put pressure on Hamas, but he says that international law is unequivocal in requiring Israel as the occupying power to allow humanitarian support in.
So that's yesterday's 6 o'clock news, talking about the Israeli, basically these changes in Israel, Martin, and also mainly Netanyahu giving this announcement, as we were talking earlier on. It's a little bit, isn't it fair to say that many, many Israelis are now starting to want to get rid of this guy?
He's never been popular with certain people in Israel. But of course,
but this is—he's making things worse. What I'm trying to say is the mask has completely slipped now. Surely,
yes. But but in order to keep his right wing coalition together, he has got to pursue the war to the bitter end.
So this is really just about him and his political and actually his survival, his freedom. Because, you know, if he's not in charge, he's a little bit like a kind of Oliver Cromwell figure. That if he's not allowed to stay in charge, he may end up in jail.
That's right. But of course, Smotrich and Gvir are, you know, they've got their own agenda, which Netanyahu is pandering to. I think, we're going to have to, ultimately, war...
What about China? Your beloved China. They're quite a powerful force on the world stage. Couldn't they, at the UN Security Council, propose a motion? I'm sure the Russians would back it. Many other countries would back it, saying we need a peacekeeping force in there.
Now, they've already proposed various things, and they get vetoed by the United States.
We don't hear anything about China making these international moves.
No, well, China
moves.
At one stage brought Hamas...
Is it because we're not hearing about it, or because they're not making those moves?
No, don't forget, China's quite a long way away, and they've got a lot of things to think about. Yeah?
So they can't be bothered to sort this out, though they might... I mean, the world stage, they're not really up to the job, are they?
They are basically focusing, as you might expect,
on themselves. On China. Want to make lots of money and take
Well, no, they
over
want to raise the
bit.
Quality of life of their own people.
They don't have a... I mean, this wouldn't take that much, would it, to propose a motion at the UN for peacekeeping forces
in Gaza? You can't put peacekeeping forces in unless both sides have agreed to a ceasefire. Okay? So if there's no ceasefire, you can't have a peacekeeping force.
Well, there is a ceasefire. It's just it's been broken.
Well, that's right. So that means there isn't one.
Well, maybe there should be some intervention like there was in Yugoslavia.
Yes, I tend to agree. And I think maybe what should happen if we're going to have a base like Akrotiri, which we used to destroy Gaddafi and to destroy Serbia, we could easily use that base to destroy Israel. And don't forget, we went to war with Israel in the 1940s. They killed lots and lots of British military personnel.
They went to war with us.
That's right. maybe it's time for us to pay them back.
And also, I think another major, I mean, you've been talking about this the last few weeks. It's horrifying on this programme to just be repeating the same story again and again about no aid being allowed through. These people are now starving.
That's right. And ultimately, I would argue that that kind of crime is war-worthy. Israel needs to be given a good hiding by somebody. Maybe the Iranian general staff are ready for that job. And, of course, they're only the problem for the Israelis, it's quite a small place, yeah? A country the size of Wales. If they come under sustained attack by Iranian missile batteries, they will lose a lot of soldiers, just like the Ukrainians have been losing.
Now, on Gaza, there is
actually, weapons,
I think, a brilliant speech by Jeffrey Sachs, again, Jeffrey Sachs. It's quite difficult to find. He gave it to something called the Asia Society in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And but it's an amazing speech, and it's like he's surrounded by people who just want to see what's going on in the Middle East and Ukraine sorted out. Will the United States please start behaving himself? And of course, as you've said many times, and I've said, Martin, he knows all these people personally, many of the people he knows. And in his speech, I'm not going to play an excerpt from it now. I mean, there's a sort of, I've got a 7 or 8 minute excerpt. Let's not bother with that. But I will put the full speech up on our show page for those that are fans like I am of Jeffrey Sachs later on at thisweek.org.uk. And we're going to go to Gaza this week. I've got another report through from the lovely Fatima in northern Gaza, in a corner of freedom, rather like we are. So let's have a listen to her report this week. And she focuses on the lack of food and the lack of humanitarian aid.
Hi, this is Fatima reaching out to you from a corner of freedom in northern Gaza under the Zionist occupation forces' most intense reporting restrictions in human history. The humanitarian situation in Gaza continues to deteriorate rapidly. Palestinians are facing extreme hunger due to severe restrictions imposed by Israel occupation, which have blocked aid from entering the territory. Constant airstrikes and shelling have left many dead or injured, while the health system is in collapse, with 18 hospitals reportedly out of service after repeated attacks on medical facilities. Palestinian families are being forced to flee from one makeshift tent to another as their homes are being destroyed daily by ongoing bombings. The crisis extends beyond Gaza, with Palestinians in the West Bank facing escalating violence aimed at erasing their identity, their existence, the widespread displacement and destruction. More than 40 Palestinians have been killed, 21,000 displaced and 318 arrested since the beginning of the ongoing Israeli aggression on Jenin and its camp in the northern occupied West Bank for the 98th consecutive day, according to the media committee in Jenin camp. The today's statistical report issued by Gaza's Ministry of Health shows that 51 martyrs, including one retrieved, have arrived at the Gaza Strip hospitals, along with 113 injuries in the past 24 hours. Several victims are still trapped under the rubble and on the roads as ambulance and civil defense crews cannot get them. The number of martyrs and injuries since 18 March 2025 has reached 2,273 martyrs and 5,864 injuries, while the death toll resulting in the ongoing genocide since October 7, 2023 until now has risen to 52,365 with 117,905 injuries reported. Children are among the most affected. According to the Euromed Human Rights Monitor, 600 Palestinian children were killed in Gaza within just 30 days, a toll that could fill an entire school. The UN now describes Gaza as a graveyard for children. The tragedy in Gaza is not limited to scenes of continuous bombing and killing. It extends to the pain of survivors whose journey of suffering begins as soon as they are classified as wounded and injured. The catastrophe becomes even harsher when the injuries are classified as burns. Burns have recently constituted the largest percentage of injuries resulting from the occupation's use of internationally banned weapons that leave wounds difficult to treat or recover from. This tragedy is exacerbated by the ongoing policy of extermination and siege, turning individual pain into a collective wound. Humanitarian organizations report that over 14,000 children have died since the start of Israel's genocide, with many more injured, missing, or buried under the rubble. Aid groups warn of a catastrophic crisis marked by trauma, hunger, and lack of medical care. Despite mounting evidence, Western governments have so far declined to impose arms embargoes on Israel. Experts and human rights advocates describe the starvation of civilians in Gaza as a war crime and a crime against humanity.
Well, it's heartbreaking to hear all of these things, isn't it? But there's some people like her still speaking out in the situation that they're in. And this is going to carry on being, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the number one issue on the planet. We're not going to let this go. And I think, you know, the people in Russia, obviously, they're more concerned with what's going on in the Ukraine. I think people in Britain are very aware of what's going on in Palestine, especially younger people, and the shame of our government's position. We are joining in on the Israeli side.
I mean, I think the thing is, Martin, you and I differ on tactics, because you seem to think that it's a potentially a good idea for somebody to really hit Israel, to attack Israel, to make them pay, whatever, I don't know, hit the presidential palace with a bunker buster or something, kill Netanyahu. In a way, the inaction from the surrounding countries such as Iran, Jordan, Egypt, is having a toll on Netanyahu, isn't it? He's finding himself increasingly isolated at home, as are his supporters in America and Britain.
Yes, I can see what you're saying, but that means what we ought to be doing is putting an arms embargo on. Britain wants...
Well, like the Spanish.
Yeah, well, that's right. Put an arms embargo on, and then
maybe
we can look at the electricity taken.
Maybe, well, yes, but then isn't that worth it? Well, I mean, do we need really?
Yes. Well, I mean, but
do we care so much about our electricity? Maybe we can play tennis and write the scores down on paper.
Yes. Okay. I'm just want to say to you, Tony, that I would like a negotiated solution to this. All sensible people, would rather have jaw than war.
Do you think Netanyahu is deal ready?
No, he isn't. That's quite clear.
Well, how are you going to get your negotiators?
Well, in that case, we move on to option two, which is warfare. Okay, there it is.
Well, what's that going to achieve?
The destruction of the Israeli military will destroy the state. The state will collapse. Loads of people will have to leave, like the Algerian settlers had to leave.
Americans will come in, won't they? Like, yes, a knight in shining armour in their great big planes full of American soldiers.
Yeah, no, their great big aircraft carriers, which are actually...
No, planes. They'll fly
the planes from the aircraft carriers, but the aircraft carriers can be sunk.
They've got a whole load of Air Force in the region. They've been flying American Air Force into Qatar or somewhere?
But all of that air power is so 1970s. The Houthis and the Iranians and the Russians have got what modern air power looks like, which is missiles.
The Americans will send soldiers in to help with those poor Israelis. Will be all helped by the Americans. Well, and also, anybody that's been doing this will be hit by the Americans and hit hard.
Yes. So, in other words, we're not just talking about defeating Israel here. We're talking about defeating the United States and Britain. It's World War III. It is.
So
really.
That's what you want, is it?
No, it's not what I want, Tony. It's just what's going to happen.
It seems to be what you want.
All right, Tony, you want a negotiated solution, and so do I. I'm just saying, as an objective observer, I'm saying there isn't one to be had.
A tactic in this is for the countries like Iran to do nothing and to just sit there and watch while the whole world can see what Netanyahu and his racist, evil thugs are up to.
That's what they've been doing.
And those here in Britain and London and in Washington that are supporting
them. That's what they've been doing. That's exactly what they've been doing. Remember, the last blow in this fight was struck by the Israelis on the Iranians, and the Iranians have not retaliated. They're trying to negotiate about their own interests. They want to have nuclear power, and they want to be sanctions lifted on Iran. And it would be irresponsible of the Iranian government to sacrifice Iran's interests for the Palestinians. But if they are directly attacked, and the Houthis are already being directly attacked, it's time to get the gloves off and give Americans, Israelis, and British some bloody noses.
What do you think the advice of the Mossad is to Netanyahu, their foreign secret service?
I do not know, because there are factions within all of this, but that some factions are saying that this is mad and we're going to destroy the country. I've seen people saying
well,
that.
Well, anyway, you may be right, because a guy called Danny Yatom, who's a former director general of Mossad, was on the BBC last night talking about all this.
In Israel, opposition to the war in Gaza is growing. In recent weeks, thousands of reservists from all branches of the military have signed letters demanding that Israel stop fighting and concentrate instead on reaching a deal to bring back the remaining hostages being held by Hamas. The government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that only by keeping up military pressure can the hostages be brought home. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams has met some of those involved in the latest protests.
The war grinds on. It's been weeks since Israel broke the ceasefire, sending troops back into combat. 18 months ago, few Israelis doubted the war's logic. Now, more and more are saying it's gone on long enough.
Israel is going to a very bad place.
Danny Yatom is a former head of Israel's spy agency, Mossad.
We understand since a long time that what bothers mainly Netanyahu is his own interests. And in the list of priorities is interests, and the interest of having the government stable are the first ones and not the hostages.
Some people will say inevitably, oh, they're just the usual suspects. They never liked Netanyahu. They were trying to get rid of him before the war. But you are politically motivated.
I signed my name, not because of any political reason, but because of a national reason. I am highly concerned that my country is going to lose its way.
Israel relies heavily on reservists to fight its wars. Hundreds of thousands answering the call after October the 7th, eager to serve. But now more and more are refusing and signing public letters of protest, like Yoav, who served in Gaza last summer. It's not his real name. He's asked us to protect his identity, and his words are read by a BBC producer.
I had the feeling that I needed to go to help my brothers and sisters. I had the feeling that what we were doing there was maybe more of the same, but it wasn't so cynical. I believed that I was doing something good, complicated, but good. But now, I don't see it in the same way anymore.
Tel Aviv, a familiar weekly spectacle. Streets regularly shut down by those who oppose the war. So it's Saturday night in Tel Aviv when anti-war protesters take over the streets and briefly bring traffic to a standstill. These people with their flags, their bullhorns and their placards have long accused the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of prolonging the war to pander to his far-right cabinet colleagues, without whose support his political career would probably end. There's a lady here carrying a poster which says the Netanyahu government is using the hostages as a human shield. Doron Meinrath is here, handing out stickers urging reservists to refuse if asked to go back to Gaza. He's a former colonel in the armored corps, troubled by Israel's conduct in Gaza from the beginning, but especially since the ceasefire collapsed in March.
The second time that they begin the war after the ceasefire, I think most of the people understand that this is totally political. Okay, it's for bringing Ben-Gvir back to the government, to prevent any chance to election. And also they understand that all the kidnappers are going to die because of it.
Benjamin Netanyahu seems undaunted, speaking of his determination to defeat Hamas during a visit to troops in Gaza last month. Military pressure, he says, the best way to bring the hostages home. But with letters of protest accumulating and reserve attendance dropping week by week, pressure is mounting on the Prime Minister to find another way.
That report from our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
So there's the BBC making it absolutely clear that Israel broke the ceasefire. And it's quite significant, isn't it, when your former intelligence chiefs come out and say you've got it all wrong.
Yes, it is. I mean, there are two things that could go on. But people might have ideological reasons for opposing the war, but other people who are possibly part of the establishment, they've got rational reasons because we're going to lose. It's not just a question of deciding to go to war and, oh, well, I've made my mind up to go to war and therefore we're going to win. One of the problems is you can decide to go to war and then you lose. Because that, you know, it should be a small print on warmongers. You know, the warmongers take no responsibility for any death or damage or loss from the war that they are selling you. Yeah. And of course, people like him who've been involved in the military for years, what's going to happen if we carry on down this road is we're going to go to war with Iran. And we're going to lose.
This is Danny Yatom, who's a former boss of Mossad and also a whole load of reservists. Now, they're just embarking now on another call-up. Do you think they're going to get the soldiers that they want to fight in Gaza again?
I think they're having problems because, as I say, they're used to fighting blitzkrieg wars where people get, it's like a sort of people's summer holiday. They go and invade Lebanon, it takes a few months and then it's all over. This is going to be more like Ukraine, going on for years and millions of soldiers get died.
I'd like to think that this is quite significant, that these figures are coming out now and saying these things, that the BBC's tone as well seems to be changing. They're quite obviously saying that the breakdown in the ceasefire was caused by the Israelis. What do you think? He's running out of options, Netanyahu, isn't he?
Well, that's why he may fly forward and attack Iran. And drag everybody down with him.
With the Americans. Do you think this is what the plan is?
That's
is it from Diego
plan.
Garcia?
And the British too. Yes. I mean, what the British should be doing.
Will any of these three countries, Britain, America, and Israel, survive such an assault?
Well, the problem is,
we're
currently at war with Russia.
Europe's going to be against. I mean, the whole world would be against. And actually, let's think. At the centre of all this is a certain Tampon Charlie. Britain created America. Britain created Israel. Britain is right in the middle of all of this.
Well, Britain has always been in the middle of all of it. And in fact, what I feel like saying to Nigel Farage, perhaps, what's your position on this, Nigel? Are we going to fix the potholes in the road in Britain, or are we going to keep a base in Akrotiri for your Israeli
Never mind a silly little minnow like Farage. What about Donald Trump? Because he's just done a big rally with all his fans because he's been in power for 100 days.
They come in from the Congo. They come in from Africa. The Congo, they've emptied out their prisons into our country. But they come from Africa, Asia, South America. They come from all over bad parts of Europe. That's why we've invoked the Alien Enemies Act to expel every foreign terrorist from our soil as quickly as possible. Never forget the same people that we now claim we're just not taking this crap anymore. We can't. They're claiming that we're not allowed to deport illegals, and they're the ones who orchestrated an 8-year campaign to jail their political opponents. Do you know what I mean? They want to jail. They want to jail. That's all they can do, jail their political opponents. What they did to people is a disgrace. And now they come after us. Why are you not nice to them? Why are you not nice to them? They tried to jail your president. They tried to jail. Except for the really courageousness of a few very good judges, you know, we could have been calling you from the other side of the bar saying, hey, fellas, how about a little protest? How about a little protest? But they cheered the assassination of CEOs, looted our cities, and destroyed our property. No, they tried to jail our politicians, and they tried to jail a lot of people, many of whom didn't even know what the hell they were being looked at for. These people are criminals. If they had their way, we would be living in a third world hellhole. That's what they want. Removing the invaders is not just a campaign pledge. It's my solemn duty as commander-in-chief. I have an obligation to do it. Save our country. And that's why we got, despite the fake polls, you know, they do these polls where they interview far more Democrats than Republicans. I saw them over the last few days, and I had them checked out. They interview far more Democrats for the polls. They interview Democrats by big numbers and then Republicans by small. They say, Trump only has a 44% approval rating. Well, it's actually not bad. But when you figure that if it were a legit poll, it would be in the 60s or 70s. These people are a bunch of crooked people. No, they interview more Democrats than Republicans. In other words, they take the poll and they interview Democrats. They poll Democrats. And then they say, they try and depress it as much, just like they write bad stories. 97% of the stories written about me, think of it, were negative. And yet we won in a landslide because they have no credibility. And also, we cannot allow a handful of communist radical left judges to obstruct the enforcement of our laws and assume the duties that belong solely to the President of the United States. Judges are trying to take away the power given to the President to keep our country safe, and it's not a good thing. But I hope for the sake of our country that the Supreme Court is going to save this, because we have to do something. These people are just looking to destroy our country. Nothing will stop me in the mission to keep America safe again. It's very simple. Keep America safe again.
Nothing will stop him? Well, I wonder whether the markets might.
Well, that's right. I mean, that is really sinister demagoguery. You know, that is on the level of Adolf Hitler in terms of the sort of, you know, the emotional impact and all the rest of it that he's trying to, it's the enemies, our enemies are trying to destroy us and we've got to destroy them first, all of that stuff.
But I mean, he's just talking really about mass migration and trying to stop it, isn't he? Not Hitler at all.
Well, no, but he's saying all of the people who are trying to mass migrate are all criminals. Now, that's patently not the case.
No, they're mostly economic people that want a better life.
That's right.
And in a way, you see, even Trump, I think, has said in the past anyway, that he respects them for that. He just doesn't want them to be allowed to do it. But, I mean, it's definitely concentrating. I mean, that's obviously a very long, and I'll put the full speech up on our show page if you want to torture yourself listening through it. But, I mean, you know, sometimes it's entertaining. Trump can be entertaining. But
need to hear it.
Like you say, you know, it is... there's very little on foreign policy.
No, because most Americans just think that that foreign policy is a boring thing.
I'm going to stop the Ukraine war in one day.
Well, that's
bring peace to the. We're going to sort out the Middle East. Well, you're going to sort it out by just bulldozing the whole of Gaza. Is that going to sort anything out?
Well, that's right. So, I mean, he's a very dangerous person because he's so unstable. And you know, he said, well, I won by a landslide. He didn't win by a landslide. If there'd been a second round vote, as there would be in France or Russia, he probably wouldn't even be the president. So there we are. But at the same time, he's got this immense self-belief, and the people who support him see him as the saviour. But in actual fact, his tariff policy has wrecked the post-war economic order from 1945.
Well, we'll see if it actually happens.
Oh, it has.
It might not happen.
No, it doesn't matter, because he's brought it in now.
Because he's talking about it.
The World Trade Organization no longer exists. All of these, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
That's not just Trump that's done that.
No. I'm just pointing out that if you smash all these agreements, and it's like smashing the China all
over,
you can't just put it back together again.
As Michael explained very well, that the conditions for tariffs are not quite right now. But anyway,
well, you can have tariffs, but the point is the uncertainty is destroying confidence in the markets. Satyajit Ray, who I read on Naked Capitalism yesterday, has pointed out the derivatives bomb is about to go off. Yeah, there is more stupid money packed into the derivatives market than in 2008.
Possibly a good thing if we get rid of these derivatives.
Well, no, but it'll get rid of the derivatives by
getting
rid of everybody. The whole world economy is going to go, apart from Russia and China, who have been under sanctions, and they're in a position now to fight World War III without the Western financial support, you know, because they're not going to get that. So, in other words, we're moving towards World War III with the West going to crash into a massive depression, and the Chinese and the Russians have actually worked themselves into a position where it won't affect them. And that's how wars are won and lost.
Maybe, yeah. So last week we had Don Jeffries on. Fantastic, I think you'll agree. And I hope you managed to get a chance to listen to the full interview with him. Bullyocracy, fantastic book. Another one of his books, Survival of the Richest, which is all all about the sort of Darwinian stuff we were hearing about from Nick Land and Curtis Yarvin earlier, and Elon Musk and Yuval Noah Harari and the rest of them. So what about American politics? One of the things he was talking about was this this guy, R. Bud Dwyer, who was the treasurer or the treasury secretary for, I think it was it, Pennsylvania, who shot himself on live TV because he was about to be indicted for something he didn't do. And he was actually an honest politician. So I thought I'd try and dig out the speech, which is what we won't, we don't worry, you won't be hearing him shooting himself. But this is what he said just before he did shoot himself on live television back in, I think it was 1981. I'm not absolutely sure. I'll check that. But here he is, R. Bud Dwyer, a politician in America with integrity.
It is not as sexy or as exciting as the Iranian arms deal, but it is in the long term and more important to the American people and the survival of our former government. I would also urge you and your media employers to work for the repeal of the death penalty, unless the test would be absolutely no doubt. I regret that on several occasions when I was a member of the legislature that I voted for the death penalty. As a result of what has happened to me in this case, I am convinced that innocent people have been found guilty and have been executed. And 2 weeks ago, if you saw 60 Minutes, they discussed the Neil Ferber case in Philadelphia, where a person was convicted of murder and was on death row and then was finally discovered he did not commit that murder. Around the turn of the century, the muckraking journalist Lincoln Steffens authored the book The Shame of the Cities. His book was largely responsible for much-needed improvement in the living conditions and working conditions of the slum dwellers in America's cities. Lincoln Steffens' journalistic goal was, quote, to see if the shameful facts spread out in all their shame would not burn through our civic shamelessness and set fire to American pride, close quote. Perhaps what America needs most now is another Lincoln Steffens, an author who will write a best-selling book entitled The Shame of Our Law. As my political career draws to a close, I want to thank the people who made it possible, beginning with the good people of Crawford County, who in 1964 had the faith to elect a 24-year-old as the youngest member of the General Assembly, and then the people of Crawford, Mercer, and Eastern Erie counties, who in 1970 elected me to the state Senate, thanks to the voters of Pennsylvania, who elected me treasurer in 1980, and in 1984 saw through the sham of the CT allegations and reelected me by a margin of 310,000 votes. In all, I participated successfully in 8 primary elections, 8 general elections, and 1 election for delegate to the Republican National Convention, which was my personal bicentennial project. And I'm on the last page now, and I don't have enough to pass out, but Duke, I'll leave this here, and you can make copies for the people. There's a few extra copies here right now. I thank the good Lord for giving me 47 years of exciting challenges, stimulating experiences, many happy occasions, and most of all, the finest wife and children any man could ever desire. Now my life has changed for no apparent reason. People who call and write are exasperated and feel helpless. They know I'm innocent and want to help, but in this nation, the world's greatest democracy, there is nothing they can do to prevent me from being punished for a crime they know I did not commit. Some who have called have said I am a modern-day Job. Judge Muir is also noted for his medieval sentences. I face a maximum sentence of 55 years in prison and a $300,000 fine for being innocent. Judge Muir has already told the press that he, quote, felt invigorated when we were found guilty, and he plans to imprison me as a deterrent to other public officials. But it wouldn't be a deterrent because every public official who knows me knows that I am innocent. It wouldn't be a legitimate punishment because I've done nothing wrong. Since I'm a victim of political persecution, my prison would simply be an American gulag. I ask those that believe in me to continue to extend friendship and prayer to my family, to work untiringly for the creation of a true justice system here in the United States, and to press on with the efforts to vindicate me so that my family and their future families are not tainted by this injustice that has been perpetrated on me. We were confident that right and truth would prevail, and I would be acquitted, and we would devote the rest of our lives working to create a justice system here in the United States. The guilty verdict has strengthened that resolve. But as we've discussed our plans to expose the warts of our legal system, people have said, why bother? No one cares. You'll look foolish. 60 Minutes, 2020, the American Civil Liberties Union, Jack Anderson, and others have been publicizing cases like yours for years, and it doesn't bother anyone. At this point in time...
The state treasurer of Pennsylvania shot and killed himself today during a news conference. R. Bud Dwyer recently was convicted of bribery. He said he was innocent. He criticized everyone connected with his case before making certain television cameras covered his suicide today.
Those present thought that he was going to resign. Instead, Dwyer took out a .357 Magnum. A few seconds later, he put the gun in his mouth and fired. He died where he fell.
Well, a rare, honest politician. That takes quite a lot of guts to do that. But as Don Jeffries pointed out last week, none of the news reports actually really quoted his speech. So they all said, oh, he did a long rambling speech and then he killed himself on television.
Yeah, but of course, you know, it's hard to comment on this because you've got to know whether the bribery... He claims that he's been accused of bribery and he's innocent. He might be. I don't know.
Don't think people like that get fitted up?
No, I do. Honest. No, it's quite possible.
Honest politicians we were talking earlier on about our very own Metro Mayor here, Thursday Metro Mayor.
Yeah.
Politicians do get fitted up. I'm not saying that he has been or not, but Dwyer makes a very good case there for even just in his little speech in explaining why he's not prepared to put up with being a victim of a miscarriage of justice. He doesn't give them the opportunity for that.
Okay. Well, I mean,
and actually, it's shows like this and the television stations, that is the last court of appeal for people like that, isn't it?
It is. And obviously, if you're going to make... I mean, the fellow we had on last week has obviously researched the case, so he knows what the allegations were and all the rest of it. Obviously, it's hard for me to comment about a corruption case in Pennsylvania in 1981. You know, you'd have to get the internet...
I'm not asking you, Martin. No. You're being a little bit annoying there. This is the principle, isn't it? Someone is actually prepared to shoot themselves on live TV... rather than be fitted up as some sort of criminal politician by the criminals.
Yeah, well,
in the justice system.
Aaron Banks burned himself to death outside the Israeli embassy and he made it clear what he was doing it for. That's a much more significant political statement in my view.
Okay, so let's also have a look at the Kashmir, which we mentioned last week. There was a little bit of confusion. I don't know if you can explain it, because we got a message last week from one of the listeners about this guy. Oh, what is his name? Khwaja Asif. The defence minister in Pakistan, saying that they've been doing dirty work for Britain and America for about 30 years. And you thought it was somebody else. Who did you think it was sending this in?
I don't know. It's because it was Terry, wasn't it, somebody? I can't remember. It doesn't matter.
Teddy.
I only got a very brief...
Right. Anyway, well, thank you, Teddy, for sending it in, because it's fascinating. Let's have a listen to it now. It's a Sky News interview where the interviewer is really pressing this guy from Pakistan, saying, you know, you must be very, 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 very annoyed that the Indians are blaming you for this. So let's have a listen to what he has to say.
You do admit, sir, that Pakistan has had a long history of backing and supporting and training and funding these terrorist organizations.
Well, we have been doing this dirty work for the United States for about 3 decades, you know, and West, including Britain.
So that's your argument, that...
That was a mistake, and we suffered for that. And that is why you are saying this to me. If we had not joined the war against Soviet Union and later on the war after 9/11, track record, you know, was unimpeachable track record.
So there he is. I mean, it's a military government there. It's not a proper elected Imran Khan. The Prime Minister's in jail, but he's still telling it like it is, isn't he? He's saying that Brits and the Americans have been doing dirty work for us in Pakistan for 30 years.
Well, we've been doing dirty work for them. Don't forget that Al-Qaeda was created by MI6.
They are doing dirty work for us. That's what he said.
No, if you
actually... They, being Pakistan,
yes.
We, the Pakistanis, are doing dirty work for the Brits and the Americans.
That's right. That's the way around. That's right, because the whole creation of jihadi terrorism was a creation of Operation Cyclone. And Pakistan, MI6 was the lead agency on it because they used to be...
And he said it was a mistake.
I think what's happening, the Pakistani establishment are now beginning to realise that they are, you know, they're going to be, they need to align probably with China more and with the West less, which is, of course, where Imran Khan was going. Imran Khan was pushed out because he'd been talking to Putin and he refused to support the West position on Ukraine.
Adil Raja, who we had on last week, he was he's been saying this week, he's saying, actually him saying that is really an admission that, that Pakistan is now more aligned with China than it is with the United States.
Well, it's always been aligned with China, but they've been, you can imagine being Pakistan and you're surrounded by enemies, you've got to try and keep everybody on side. And so, you know, the deep state in Pakistan is the General Gul, who used to be an ISI guy, he said soon after 9/11, he said, well, it's obvious the Americans did that. And of course, it is.
Well, we were very privileged.
To military people like him.
Privileged. Actually, Adil and I were on India Today. I think it was yesterday? No, was it yesterday? Yeah. And they did an interview about all this whole... But the points that we were making were that much of this terrorism, Martin, and we've been banging on about this for years, decades almost, is being carried out by intelligence services. So RAW and the ISI, RAW being in India and the ISI being Pakistan, have got to always be like the first prime suspects, but they're not.
That's right. And of course, don't forget, it's not just subcontinental evil people. We've also got MI6, we've got Mossad, the DGSE in France. They're all most terrorism, apart from the occasional...
He's linking Pakistan immediately to the Brits and the Americans, yes, and saying they're the most...
Well, I mean, I think it's likely that this attack is a deliberate... Because it suits the Western powers to keep Pakistan and India at each other's throats, because it prevents the whole BRICS process from developing.
Well, the Indians reacted very quickly to all this, cutting off this water treaty, and also they've been going around in Kashmir. I mean, it's horrific, isn't it, really? Because in many ways, we were talking last week about the decapitation policy of the Ukrainians, the Nazi Ukrainians, and MI6, have a decapitation policy. In other words, assassination of Russian generals. The same exact policy is something which has been pursued by the Israelis as well. Well, isn't it interesting that the same kind of policy is being produced by India as Israel? This is a demolition of the houses of suspects. So why is it that these... I mean, I'm just interested in where these policies... Why is it a good idea to go and demolish the home of someone you suspect of maybe being a terrorist, but you haven't proved anything?
Well, it's counterinsurgency coin, isn't it? You know, the so-called experts were supposedly the Israelis, and the Indian army copies them and all the rest of it.
But Channel 4 News mentioned this, and I thought, this is interesting. So the Indians are doing just what the Israelis have been doing. Let's have a listen to this Channel 4 News excerpt from earlier this week.
Authorities in India say they've demolished houses belonging to two suspected militants in response to Tuesday's gun attack on tourists in Indian-run Kashmir. There are also reports that troops have exchanged fire along the line of control that divides Indian and Pakistani administered Kashmir as tensions escalate following the shooting, which left 26 people dead. India says there were Pakistani elements behind the killings. The nuclear armed nations have unleashed a raft of measures against each other, with Pakistan closing its airspace to Indian airlines.
I mean, it's amazing how just a little incident like that, where I say little, 26 people killed, can set these two countries against each other, both nuclear armed.
Well, it is, but, you know, Gavril Princip assassinated Archduke Ferdinand, and then all the consequences flowed, didn't it?
Anyway, let's have a listen to another one of your... you're getting a bit of a treat. I think, at least you introduced me to her. The woman's called Cynthia Chung. Can you just tell us a bit about her?
Well, I think she's based in Canada. She's of Chinese extraction, and she's associated with Matthew Ehrenberg, I think, Canadian Patriot Review, and it's a kind of, she's very interested in the kind of the history of intelligence service operations and the counterculture and all this sort
well,
of stuff.
Well, she's the person to bring in on this, and this is an excerpt from a longer interview, which, of course, I'll put up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, over to Cynthia Chung to look at the... Gladio factor.
When Alan Dulles became the director of the CIA, you had Frank Wisner, or Matt says Wisner. I don't actually know. Is it Wisner or Wisner?
I'll just keep saying
Wisner. But so he became part of the OPC. I think it's a very boring name. They like to do this on purpose to not draw attention, but it's Office of Policy Coordination, I believe, OPC. And that was the clandestine operations unit that Frank Wisner was in charge of within the CIA. But again, even within the CIA at the time, because it took time for Alan Dulles to have like control over so much, a lot of the CIA was not actually aware at all of what the OPC was doing. Actually, this was before I think Alan Dulles even became the director, and he was the first civilian CIA director, which also says something. So at this time, Frank Wisner was directly working with British special forces in World War II. So this must have been, now my timeline's getting all weird. So I guess that must have been OSS. They had already had it set up. But Frank Wisner had been in charge of overseeing American, special forces working with the British special forces, and they were considered brothers in arms during World War II. Not to say that everything they were doing then was bad or anything, but the point being is that the Churchill secret army idea was not a good thing that ultimately did take over American foreign policy as well and shaped the whole clandestine operation, philosophy. And what Prouty brings up in his book, The Secret Team, is that Kennedy, when he came in to office, unfortunately, Kennedy did not have a good relationship with the U.S. Army or the intelligence. And he kind of made the mistake, in my opinion, of trying to have too much change too quickly, especially without enough of a trusting relationship with the U.S. military, which caused a lot of problems for him, like at the very beginning. And with Dulles at this point being very high level, you had CIA agents within the U.S. military, within the U.S. government, who were under, government or military titles, but they were ultimately in service to the CIA. It was this like this infiltration of an ideology that was turning over the traditions, the good traditions of the American government and the American military, and they were slowly taking over these things. So Kennedy understood this, but I think kind of similar to Trump, you have a lot of these people being brought in, and if you don't know enough about them, it's a really difficult situation to have to deal with. They might be selling themselves a certain way, but there's no way to know. So Prouty was making the point that Maxwell Taylor, who was a military man who resigned during Eisenhower's administration, was brought in through the corridors of Dulles. And when the Bay of Pigs fiasco happened and Kennedy was, investigating this with the Cuban Study Group and all that, Maxwell Taylor was actually being promoted, unbeknownst to Kennedy, as a possible solution to reformation of the U.S. military. But in fact, the reality was, and Maxwell Taylor had already written a book about this, I forgot the name of it, it's like the something trumpet, that he was actually for counterinsurgency tactics. So when he was eventually made the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff position, which Lemnitzer was that position before, and he was the one who suggested Operation Northwood to Kennedy, which was a false flag proposition to attack American people and American military personnel and blame it on Castro so that you could have a direct invasion of Cuba. This is what they were constantly trying to entrap Kennedy into. Lemnitzer's contract was not renewed by Kennedy. Lemnitzer was taken up to head NATO within a month's time for NATO's Gladio operations. And so Kennedy thought he was making a decision to return back to the traditional U.S. military ways by putting Maxwell Taylor in. But unbeknownst to him, it actually inflamed the situation greatly under counterinsurgency. And Taylor looks like he might have been even more radical than Lemnitzer. And it's the same problem, the CIA, Dulles was fired, Bissell was fired, but these people were just replaced by other people who were beholden to Alan Dulles. So it's a very, very difficult situation for Kennedy to be in. Prouty makes the point that under Maxwell Taylor, this is where the whole doctrine of the U.S. military was changed for essentially a Gladio doctrine. So people who were being trained from this period on thought that they were representing the values and the traditions and the philosophies and so forth of the U.S. military, when actually they were being taught something completely different. And this is where like 40 host countries started to let these units come in. And increasingly, the U.S. military was being taught that they should be in charge of economic reform, political reform, cultural reform. And we see this kind of like with the Iraq War after 9/11, where all of a sudden you have the U.S. military in charge of like everything in terms of like reforming a country, which the military should never be in charge of that sort of thing. And you see like military dictatorships starting to sprout up in South America. This was, again, this idea that it was up to the military to have these things enforced forcefully and increasingly through parallel state mechanisms. It's like black ops, black budget type operations. And when they would go into these friendly countries, not communist countries, these are supposed to be friendly allied countries to the United States, they would train paramilitary units. So as soon as that country does not like what's happening, they're overthrown and, you know, puppet leaders are being put in place. So it's completely undemocratic. And these people are all being selected and put in place to be in service of the Gladio ideology, the Alan Dulles ideology, which was in service to the, you know, Churchill's kind of foreign policy view. It goes further than Churchill, but just to make it easy for people to understand, it was this idea that Churchill was representing the high cabal idea, the League of Nations concept, where you have like about six, you know, control centers in the world, and then everything else is like a satrapy, a breadbasket, this ideology.
Well, I mean, she's covered a lot of ground there. And of course, she keeps using this word gladio. If the people who are listening don't know what gladio is, I suggest you carry out
the search. Isn't it interesting how in the Kennedy era, all this, when she's explaining there in fine detail about how the whole military doctrine changed, you know, don't be too friendly with the United States because, you know, you're going to end up with all these US operatives inside deciding what's going to be your future. And so don't kid yourself that the Americans are your friends. They're not. We were just chatting while that was going on about Costa Gavras, that film State of Siege, which is all about an American advisor, I think is it, to the Chilean government being kidnapped.
No, I think I mentioned the film Missing, which I believe is a Costa Gavras film as well, which is about the kidnapping.
They don't show these films much on the telly, do they?
Well, they do. It was a mainstream film.
Brilliant film.
And it had Jack Lemmon as a star. So, I mean, he's obviously, you know, somebody that people will have heard of.
But the State of Siege one was about a kidnapping where the guy is in Chile training the police to use these like paramilitary tactics and torture techniques, and so the locals just decide, right, let's just kidnap this guy, and they do. But it's a fantastic film. It's one of the best films I've ever seen. But you never ever see these things. You mentioned Zed as well. What's that about?
Well, that's about the coup in Greece in 1968.
So there are some really good feature films out there, but you never get
Costa Gavras was a committed...
Oh, wasn't he brilliant, man?
A committed great film director.
Absolutely amazing guy. Also, I suppose we need to understand with the power cuts that if your power goes out, what you should do is go and cheer, because it probably means that Britain has been doing something to annoy the Israelis.
Well, I think you've got tongue firmly in cheek there, I feel.
But part of me is saying, well, actually, this seems to be... Isn't it funny? Because South Africa's had loads and loads of power cuts. I remember being interviewed by someone in South Africa last year saying we get getting power cuts. And so, you know, maybe this is what happens, is if you don't comply with the genocide, your power is going down. You're not going to get the services that you expect and require from Babylon.
No, and of course, Trump's tariff escapade means that most developing countries are probably going to go bankrupt. The IMF has just given this Argentina a massive loan. Milei said he would never go to the IMF, but he's had to because his own policies have just nearly ruined the country. So the IMF are coming in to take over in Argentina. But of course, we're getting closer and closer to a general, something like 2008, but worse in the financial markets. And the consequences of that, with all of this other manipulation that's going on, is general anarchy,
so,
sadly.
Cynthia Chung, I thought you were a bit of an anarchist.
Well, I mean anarchy in the negative sense of the word.
Okay, like chaos. Yeah, chaos. That's their game, chaos, most definitely. So Cynthia Chung's piece there is it's called Through a Glass Darkly, Breaking History, Episode 35, How NATO's Secret Armies Took Over the US Military Intelligence. Fascinating little podcast there. Last week I mentioned Don Jeffries. Let's have him chit-chatting for a couple of minutes about the whole, I mean, what he's saying is the whole business of Kennedy and Cuba. So all the alternative community is supposed to think, oh yeah, Cuba did it. But no, he says there is a lot of reason to suspect that it was all to do with the Israelis.
If Cuba was a motive for them to kill JFK, then they failed. Because after the assassination, there was no second Bay of Pigs. There was not even an attempt. They stopped trying to assassinate Castro, and Castro outlived them all. So, I mean, in fact, Cuba died as a campaign issue. Cuba was not mentioned in the 1964 election. You'd think Goldwater would have made a big deal out of it. No, he didn't. And Nixon never did or said anything about it when he was in there. So I think this is a smokescreen. In our book, we showed how all those, there's tons of Cuban figures that are in the, were around Oswald. But I think Lee Harvey Oswald was an undercover agent. We know he's with the CIA. I think he was with the FBI as well. There's evidence to suggest that one of those two agencies assigned him at the time of the assassination. He was assigned to infiltrate a group that he was told was plotting to kill the president. I think that group included Jack Ruby, David Ferry, Clay Shaw, and Guy Bannister, and all those anti-Castro Cubans. So I think that's how he got connected. I think they were all being manipulated each other. None of them were associated with the real conspiracy. They were all being used, I think. But so I think these are much bigger people than
I suppose also by looking at what's going on in Israel now with this genocide unfolding, the horrifying, basically bringing hell to the Holy Land, you could see maybe that there were plans afoot many decades ago for this sort of power to be concentrated in this kind of crusader state there. But look, you know, I stopped you when you were just going to go on to your next book, Don.
I think we talked because The Hidden History, obviously, is again my bestseller. And I wrote Survival of the Richest after that, and that's my economic book. And that's my far left wing book. You know, so people, it really gets people confused. I think I'm a communist reading that, but I'm a populist. And Huey Long, the former governor of Louisiana, that's my all time political hero. And I think I've single handedly tried to restore Huey Long's reputation. I've communicated with his great granddaughter. We've had several conversations, and Huey Long was a great man. Our government definitely killed him. There's no question that I show that in my book. But Survival of the Richest.
So for our British audience, who is this guy and what happened?
He was the governor of Louisiana, and he called him the Kingfish. And if you go, you know, can find speeches on YouTube or whatever, just you'll get a sense of how magnetic he was still. And this guy was as colorful a character you'll ever find. He was brilliant. The Supreme Court Justice William Howard Taft said that he was the most brilliant lawyer to ever argue before the Supreme Court. And I don't think he was even 30 years old when he did that. He was elected governor of Louisiana and at a young age, and he basically rebuilt the state. He had a national movement called Share Our Wealth, and he recognized the disparity of wealth, and he wanted to ensure, because he recognized how much wealth was there then. There's obviously even more now. And he realized that if it was just shared a little bit more fairly, and as he said, his tax plan would have exempted the first $1 million of income from any tax at all. That would be about $12 million today. So nobody but the absolute top tier of the 1% would have been paying taxes. So obviously they had interest. The Rockefeller Standard Oil was constantly clashing with him. He predicted his assassination on the floor of the Senate because then he was elected to the Senate. And but before he got through with Louisiana, he paved the entire state. He built the first free healthcare clinics. He was the first one to ensure that prisoners got healthcare. They didn't get healthcare before that. He built hospitals and he built schools. He built LSU University. So he did many great things, and he saved the average person substantial costs on utilities. He eliminated personal property taxes for all but the very, very wealthy. So he was He's a great man, and he would be, you know, he must be worrying at warp speed in his grave over what's going on now.
That's Don Jeffries there, talking about the reason why he thinks it's pretty obvious that the Israelis were connected or behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy, why it can't really have been Cuba, Martin.
Well, it's definitely not Cuba. I think the argument is that it was Cuban emigres who were unhappy with
Kennedy's policy.
But
he's saying that this whole business was just dropped. There was no more really action to do with Cuba at all. So Kennedy's out of the way now. What are you going to do with Cuba? They did nothing.
Yes. So in other words, there's a strong,
good evidence
within the investigate JFK's assassination community, which I would include ourselves. We're in that community. Some people think it was the CIA because of he wouldn't.
CIA were doing it, but yes, why is the question that not many journalists bother to ask.
No, I know, but why? The Israelis clearly had a hand in it. I think that's pretty clear.
Dimona.
Yes, there's all these reasons, but of course there will be elements within the U.S. military, or you know, the Gladio apparatus, as Chung calls them.
Who would
want to, you know, there was a coalition of people who didn't want Kennedy to survive, including Lyndon Johnson, who was his supposed deputy president.
Yeah, anyway, so that was not only the end of Kennedy, as Cynthia Chung explains, it was also the end of the US as a genuine military power. They're just trying to control the world using all sorts of dark and devious methods from that moment. It's funny, isn't it? All that she was mentioning Frank Wisner there. He's the guy that got that SS general who was in charge of the Nazi nuclear weapons development program, as Todd Ryder's exposed. Wisner was the guy that got him over to the States and faked his death, so everyone would think he was gone, and then Todd has turned up an interview with the bloke 6 months after he was supposed to have died. So a funny old world, and we're going to finish this week and we could say goodbye to you, Martin. Very nice. Thank you ever so much for all your comment and etc. as usual. But this is, I think, an interesting one. I don't do stuff on the occult that much, but this is Imran Hussein. You do too much. But you see, this is where I think it's things start to get interesting, and you leave the room. But Imran Hussein, he is a Muslim imam, and he's been writing. Our old friend Moeen Yassin from the 9/11 days keeps sending me bits and bobs from him. But this one's really interesting, and he's interviewed not by me or any sort of nutcase. But here he is on speaking on RT. It's Marija on RT on. I think it's been put onto YouTube as well, but they're on Rumble mostly. Here he is talking about the similarities between the Islamic view of the end of the world and the Christian view.
There is this in common between Christian eschatology and Islamic eschatology, and our viewing audience, both Muslim and Christian in the Balkans, would understand and agree with me that both the Christian and the Muslim believe that the Messiah came, the Messiah left, and that the Messiah will return, and that the Messiah is Jesus, the son of the Virgin Mary. Let me repeat it, that both the Christian and the Muslim hold these views. And NATO cannot change that. Forget it. Now then, both the Christian and the Muslim also believe that before the Messiah returns, that there is going to be an imposter who will seek to impersonate the Messiah. The Christian knows him as the Antichrist, and the Muslim knows him as Dajjal, Al-Masih al-Dajjal, or the great pretender, the great impersonator. Now then, the Quran has two kinds of verses: those which do not have to be interpreted and those which have to be interpreted. And most of the verses of the Quran pertaining to the end time, to the end of history, are such that they have to be interpreted. And one of the foremost verses about the end time is the warning to mankind of a shadow which will now appear with three parts. And my interpretation of that shadow is that it is the Antichrist or Dajjal, the false Messiah, and that his footprints come in three parts. For me, the three parts are not World War One, World War Two, and World War Three. No. For me, the footprints are Pax Britannica and Pax Americana, and that Pax Americana cannot remain forever, not even with Donald Trump. That Pax Americana is going to fade away with the sunset, and there will be a Pax Judaica to replace it, that Israel wants to replace the United States of America as the next ruling state in the world. And when it does so, then someone will stand up in Jerusalem and he will declare falsely so, I am the Messiah. But no Christian will accept that, because every Christian knows that the Messiah is Jesus, the son of the Virgin Mary. And every Muslim, I don't know about the Muslims in the Balkans. I don't know about the Muslims in the Balkans, whether they're still sleeping or whether they'll ever wake up. But every Muslim in the rest of the world knows that the Messiah is Jesus, the son of the Virgin Mary. This is what holds both of these people together, locked together in an eschatological unity and fraternity. So when the false Messiah is to return, he will stand up in Jerusalem and say, I am the Messiah, while ruling the world. This is why Israel wants to provoke the Great War. I don't know whether Russia knows that or not, but it is most likely the Israeli Mossad which will trigger the Great War. Unless the Great War takes place, a Pax Judaica cannot replace Pax Americana. You won't find this kind of political analysis in a university classroom, not at all. This is entirely eschatological, and I am of the opinion that Islamic eschatology and Christian eschatology are destined to come even closer and closer to each other. And NATO cannot stop it.
But wouldn't you say that we are actually already living in the Pax Judaica, as you call it, having in mind that actually United States are doing everything Israel wants, and that actually Israel is the one who rules America now? Isn't this already the Pax Judaica that we are living in?
There is an eschatological aspect to this subject now that we must look at, and that is both the Quran and the Gospel, as well as the Torah, speak about a people who are an essentially godless people, but who have tremendous power, a godless people who use power to oppress, and that these are the people who are going to bring the Jews back to Jerusalem to reclaim it as their own. 2,000 years after they were expelled by divine decree, both the Quran and the Gospel and the Torah describe them as Gog and Magog. But it is a hopelessly difficult subject, hopelessly difficult subject for people who lack the capacity to think. The Quran is clear that those who bring the Jews back to Jerusalem to reclaim it as their own, 2,000 years after they were expelled by divine decree, are not an Israelite people. they do not have any genetic links with Abraham, not at all. They are Gog and Magog, and they are a European people. So yes, there is intense oppression in the Holy Land, in Gaza. There is genocide in broad daylight. But those who are committing the genocide are not the Israelite people. They are a European people, what you call a Johnny-come-lately, a European people who converted to Judaism and who are taking the Jews on the last ride on which they'll ever go. These are the same people who control power in the modern West. And Russia has recognized them in Ukraine at long last. Russia has recognized them at work in Ukraine, wanting to trigger the Great War. All that now remains is for Russia, for Moscow to recognize that the same people who are waging war on Russia in Ukraine are the same people who control power in Israel today.
So that's the fascinating Imran Hossain, Hossain, giving us a bit of another take. And again, you're not going to hear that on the BBC. I mean, it's great to hear the boss, the Mossad boss, isn't it? Actually, that's like almost like made my week. Wow. We've got some serious people actually facing reality rather than living in these kind of ridiculous myths and delusions of the Dark Enlightenment. And I'll put a link up to the full in Russia Today interview with Imran Hossain, as well as all the other clips we've had. Well, not all of them, but any of the longer ones, I will put up later this evening at thisweek.org.uk. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guests, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel via Not the BCFM Politics show page, which includes the podcast, the full-length interviews, the story links, and the comment page. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. And if you can afford it, please do think about a donation, even like £1 a month, better than nothing. Thisweekoneword.org.uk. That's where you find the link to donate. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My paperbacks about Churchill and the Nazis at the end of World War II, The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, that costs £15. Also my secret government anthology, From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination. It's a bit of a coffee table job, I think. Loads and loads of interesting little extracts. The anthology, that's called The Siege of Heaven Reader, both on eBay. And if you find the Siege of Heaven ebook with my RT articles, plus my most recent on John Dee and the Empire, etc., that's at bilderberg.org. All these are free for a slightly denuded version of PDF if you really want to read it. Nobody is stopped from doing anything, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, because being an ex-BBC person, sort of civil servant, the idea, this is public service, folks. We're not here to make you pay, but if you can pay, please do. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Do please make live recordings, and we've been streaming live from A Corner of Freedom in Bristol on DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and also on the BCFM Politics Show app. Please make sure you have it if you're up to date. If you've got a phone, Apple or Android, no problem. There it is. And if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down. The dream tree is sad.
fire and eyes to the sea. I sit at home with my hand on the cradle, rocking the love he has given to me. Long are the hours and long is the waiting, many the candle to stand and be burned. Women of whalers and women of sailors soon learn the meaning of worry and yearn. Women sing their songs of safe returning for their men. Let him only one day, someday, touch my hair again. Lo, how the dream trees sigh shaking, pretty dreams fall down on thee. Oh, how my poor heart is crying and aching, longing for one who is longing for me. waiting round every corner.
The primary reason why the individual citizens of a country create a political structure is a subconscious wish or desire to perpetuate their own dependency relationship of childhood. Simply put, they want a human god to eliminate all risk from their life, pat them on the head, kiss their bruises, put a chicken on every dinner table, clothe their bodies, tuck them into bed at night, and tell them that everything will be all right. That everything will be all right when they wake up in the morning. This public demand is incredible. So the human god, the politician, meets incredibility with incredibility by promising the world and delivering nothing.
Feeling how strong my love is for you.